All right. We'll see what we can do. Everyone talk really low. Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Mesa City Council study session for Thursday, September 2nd, 2010. If anyone's watching, we're having a little bit of problem with our audio in studio or in room or whatever you call it. So if you start hearing weird sounds, that's it. The first thing on the agenda this morning is to hear a presentation discussed by direction on the healthcare feasibility study. So, Mr. Jibjiniak, we're going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mayor. Good morning, Council. Good morning. This morning, we are here to present the findings and recommendations on two studies focused on jobs. Just a little bit. Anyway, so we're here to present the findings in two studies based on jobs in downtown Mesa. So I know the agenda really talks about here presentation, but really it should talk about a here presentation on jobs in downtown, because I think that's where the focus of both of these presentations are this morning. The Office of Economic Development did the healthcare and higher education feasibility study really to create a foundation. And this is the first step on creating or fulfilling several of the council objectives. Obviously, quality of life, economic development is important for creating quality jobs. You're going to hear that theme throughout the entire morning. So having a vision is critical. Being able to build on an expansion plan as necessary, and having clear and concise and focused results are going to be important. So, Mesa already has a strong vision. We want to focus on legacy projects and create quality jobs. Focus on industries of opportunity, healthcare, education, aerospace, tourism. And I think everybody also knows that we have to realize that to obtain the quality projects and quality jobs, we're going to have to form some form of partnership to get this accomplished. So the healthcare feasibility study was funded through community development block grant dollars in fiscal year 2010. It was directed to focus on the downtown area for the primary market area when researching the demand and demographics. So while downtown was the focal point, the consultant also took a citywide or sometimes regional approach to examining the assets of the region and recognizing that destination healthcare will serve more than a local population. Jale Donnelly from our office was the project manager and lead person on the project. Today you're going to hear from our consultants on the healthcare piece, and what they're going to be referring to is what economic development is doing now and what we need to do moving forward. So Judy Scalise with ESI Corporation is partnered with Jackie Lemblad from NGH Consulting to conduct the study. A little bit about Judy real quick, just in case anybody has not met Judy. She's the founder and principal of ESI Corporation, which specializes in economic development, market analysis, and pre-development planning services to both public and private sector clients. She's also the past chairwoman of the International Economic Development Council. Jackie Lemblad is the principal of NGH Consulting, extensive career experience in the healthcare industry with over 25 years progressive experience as a consultant and hospital executive. Most recently with Banner Sun Health Research Institute, she is an expert at designing strategic business plans, assisting hospitals with physician alignment strategies, and developing marketing and sales strategies for the healthcare industry. With that, I'll turn it over to Judy.
Thank you, Bill, and good morning, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Jackie and I are delighted to be here with you this morning and share with you the results of our healthcare market analysis and feasibility study. The overarching goal was to identify some strategies and some provide you with some findings and recommendations on how the city should go forward in creating Mesa as a healthcare destination. Our study included three elements. It was an asset inventory, a market analysis, and a comparative analysis. And under the asset inventory, we identify facilities and healthcare providers within our market trade area and primarily the East Valley to see the landscape that's in place that exists today. The market analysis looked at identification of what that primary trade area is as it relates to healthcare delivery, identified the socioeconomic demographic mix of the population, looked at population projections, which then drove the bed and physician needs analysis, gap analysis that we conducted. And then finally, a comparative analysis was prepared examining Mesa and some of Mesa's competitive communities in the East Valley, and identifying those key assets that could help drive healthcare economic development for the city. So just in an overarching sense, the healthcare industry in the U.S. today is a substantial economic driver in our economy. It's a $2.5 trillion business, one of the largest private sector employers in the country with about 17 million people. It's projected to grow over the next 10 years, about 3.2 million new jobs within the healthcare industry. So it's one of the key industries that's still growing in our economy and still creating jobs. And the multiplier effect is fairly substantial. It's a 200% return. Every dollar that's spent brings another $2 in purchased goods and services. When you start to examine Maricopa County, it's a fairly significant industry here as well, with a $19.2 billion industry, 167,000 jobs, and a median wage of these professionals within this industry of about $56,000 annual payroll. So it's fairly significant here in the county as well. Our asset inventory identified 50 facilities in the East Valley, 14 of which are hospitals, 6 are surgical centers, and 30 are urgent care facilities. So as you can see, this map is included in your report, and there's an associated table with that. So you can see that there's a tremendous amount of health care already being provided within the East Valley and the city of Mesa. So you're well served today as it stands. In terms of our findings, we determined that there was enough bed capacity, hospital bed capacity in Mesa today. There's about 1,300 plus beds, and you're currently served based on population projections. You're served through the year 2012 in terms of hospital beds, but there's a potential a need for new additional beds by the year 2013. Hospital beds are it's very expensive to develop a new hospital. The cost is about $1 million per bed. Today, no current provider are planning some additional hospital beds for the marketplace. And they're also starting to understand there could be some implications with healthcare reform. And so until that is known, nobody is really pulling the trigger to identify and locate any new hospitals. Hospital providers today are really focusing on expanding their physician services, their outpatient delivery, and their chronic care management. In addition, our findings show that currently there is no need for additional level one trauma services. 7 miles away, there's Scottsdale Healthcare Osborne facility. 12 miles away, there's Maricopa Medical Center. In addition, there's a new facility, Bannerwood, is expected to open in just adjacent to Queen Creek in Pinal County. That's expected to open in November of 2010, and they will have a full-service emergency care at that facility as well. There was a recent hospital study that was done exploring the potential of a Trauma One Care Center for pediatrics. It's expensive. It requires 24/7 physician coverage, and so people are being very cautious in terms of bringing on new facilities at this time as it relates to Trauma One Care. So based on population projections as it stands today, it's not determined that any new Trauma One Care is needed at the downtown location site, but there's certainly the potential in the future as the population continues to grow, and citing that facility, we'll look at other areas because the downtown site doesn't really have the immediate access that is necessary for that type of a facility. Other potential impacts,
Judy,
on
health. If I could ask you a question, you say the downtown site, most of the, how do patients get to Trauma One?
AeroVac,
right? So what difference would it make if it were downtown or mile away or 2 miles away or 3 miles away? Scottsdale Osborne's okay, Maricopa Medical, because we get there by AeroVac, so it doesn't really matter that we cross the river, over the river, through the bridge, woods, and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not following the downtown. I can understand the level one's not needed, but what really difference does it make where it is?
We really want level one trauma to be associated with the hospital. So if we look at the hospitals here in Mesa, we would be focusing on predominantly Banner as well as your IASIS facilities. The downtown site to which Judy's referring is the 25-acre site, if I'm correct.
Right.
And you would need to wrap around significant health care around that facility in order for level one trauma to be well supported. We do see freestanding emergency departments in our market. We see them nationwide. Level one trauma is very different animal in that we need those wraparound services. So that is the predominant reason why we would not place it at that site. The other point that Judy is making, which was your point as well, Scott, is that we do have enough level one trauma, and we need to look at the entire market, including Maricopa County.
Councilman Kavanaugh.
I'm wondering, did you talk at all to any of the East Valley fire departments and fire chiefs, because they are united in their concern that Mesa and the East Valley does need a level one trauma. So I'm still trying to understand your assumptions on why the city in East Valley does not need a level one trauma. I don't understand the underpinnings for your statement.
Our statement's based on data, as well as speaking with representatives of the Hospital Association, as well as representatives in the local emergency departments. To your question, we did not speak directly to the fire department. And again, when we look at the population-based data, and we take a broad look at Maricopa County, we do have sufficient level one trauma. I think the question would be, if we were standing back and we didn't have existing level one traumas where we do in Maricopa County, I think we'd all agree that yes, we would have one in the East Valley and we'd probably have one in the West Valley. When I used to work with Banner Sun Health, lots of discussion about when do we place level one trauma in the West Valley. I think both these markets have the same questions and issues. At Banner Desert Facility, they actually have a very strong emergency department, and there are different levels of trauma. It's my understanding they may be looking at going to level two trauma. The only difference between level two and level one, as I understand it, is you don't have 24-hour availability of neurosurgery. So at this juncture, what we're seeing is that Mesa will be taking steps toward level one trauma, and certainly in the pediatric realm, the study is showing there may very well be a need for level one pediatric trauma.
Yeah, and certainly I'm very familiar with Banner because I'm the most recent chair of their community advisory board, which had very strong discussions on the need for level one trauma, talking with the entire East Valley medical community, including the fire departments. And the reason Banner doesn't want to put one there is simply cost. It's not need. They will not disagree on the need. But the issue is, and you know it, in terms of having level one trauma, it's having the staff available, it's having the facilities available on a 24-hour basis. I happen to live right across from Banner Desert Hospital, but if I'm involved in a major motor vehicle accident with a serious injury, I have to play the crapshoot of figuring out whether someone can get me to Scottsdale or Maricopa in time. AeroVac is not always the optimum mode of transport in a heavily urbanized area such as Mesa. And so you're relying on surface transportation to get there. And quite simply, the time involved in getting to Maricopa Medical Center at Scottsdale, particularly in a city of 140 square miles, is obviously less than optimistic. So again, this is an issue where, I mean, I understand what you're talking about in terms of data, but I don't think you've drilled down deep enough and talked to the people day-to-day who deal with the issues and what residents have to face, because the need for level one trauma, at least in my opinion, has been documented at least for a decade. And it's a question of organizations such as Banner or someone else being willing to understand the need for the community and respond to that need and commit the resources in partnership with the community. That's where, again, I recognize those are your findings, but I think they're subject to disagreement.
Councilmember Higgins?
Just for clarification, this study was just done for the downtown dirt that's empty.
Correct.
So when you did all your studies of all, like, level one, it was just what is around that site, not necessarily what do we need on the east side of the city or the southeast side. simply what can be around this downtown
correct.
Site.
That's correct.
So
that's
no, I think it could be different if we were looking citywide.
Mm-hmm. And actually, that's a different study. If we were to study level one trauma, keep in mind, as you're stating, the goal for this study was to do a broad asset inventory looking at the downtown site and what are the needs specifically in downtown Mesa. So level one trauma would be a different study and a different look to consider the entire city of Mesa, what the needs are relative, again, to Maricopa County.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To support Councilmember Kavanaugh's comments, there's a certain irony. I know from an operations standpoint in the fire department, they actually respond to the hospitals and use those helipads if they're even close. So it's ironic that we go to local hospitals so we can load them up and go someplace else. So I think there's some opportunities here, and I support Councilman Kavanaugh's approach and looking deeper. So,
well, I think also we're looking what's the chicken and what's the egg. And this sort of seems like we're treating level one as the egg. Because you talk about being surrounded by medical facilities. I mean, I think we get that. We know what a level one. And the other thing is jumping clear to level one. Like you said, there's, mm-hmm. as I talk to medical professionals, I can't even get anyone to agree on what a true level one is. I mean, like you said, a level one is neurosurgery. You know, I've heard other people get more finite, says, well, if we had this but we didn't have that, that's really a level one minus. Or, you know, and I said, well, forget it. The understanding is your worst accidents, your worst injuries, 24 hours a day, where would they go? I mean, I don't care what you call those, where would that be? So maybe we're sort of quibbling about semantics and about locations. I think, I mean, my discussions with Banner and others are, and I love Banner. Banner's a great partner to the city of Mason, to our community. But as Councilmember Kavanaugh said, you know, they look at it through a very, very, mm-hmm. a very, very narrow vision, which is, can we justify the cost?
Exactly.
It's not, is there a need? And, you know, level one traumas, they're really, from my understanding, they're not a moneymaker for anybody. They are really a community service.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just, to have the kind of facilities and the resources there, thank heavens we don't have enough accidents that bad to make it happen. And so, you know, maybe we're jumping and getting a little bit too far. So just want to hope, make sure that we keep it in perspective and context.
Well, if there is strong interest in level one trauma, that is certainly something that can be studied. The other thing to consider, if we look at other cities across the United States, there are other roles the city can play other than building and developing level one trauma. Transport teams play a major role, to your point, Councilman Kavanaugh, to being able to move people rapidly to the level one trauma centers. You have some good examples even up in northern Arizona where funding has been provided for those private transport facilities to bring people to the right facilities. So there's certainly some options there if there is an interest.
Councilman Richens?
Yes, that's why they put sirens on trucks, so everybody gets out of the way so they can go fast. I think what people are taking umbrage with is that, you know, the in your PowerPoint, I mean, you led, your statement led with little need for level one trauma centers, and so you really hit, mm-hmm. I think you walked into a buzzsaw you probably weren't anticipating. When I saw that, when I was reading
it, may be early in the morning, but we are awake.
When I really had a chance to pour through it deeply for the first time last night, and when I saw this in your going to be in your presentation, I actually poured through your report to try to find what was supporting a statement that would merit a full PowerPoint slide unto itself. And really, you know, the only thing that I found was page 27, you have a little reference to a study that Banner did, I believe, 5 to 7 years ago on level one trauma center need. And
it's more recent than that, the actual study.
Your report is very thin on source material, so I don't know where you're getting a lot of your assumptions. You don't have a lot of footnotes, and I don't know where things have come from. But you guys actually didn't do a level one trauma center study.
Correct.
You're referring to a study that Banner did quite a while ago. Is that right?
It was more recent than...
The study is more recent. In fact, it's within the last couple of years, was my understanding. But
yeah, you don't have any citation again, here, so I have no idea when they did it.
Correct. So. We need to keep in mind the actual scope and focus of this particular study, and that's why I made the statement. You certainly could do a level one trauma study if that's a high interest of the council. The other thing to keep in mind, if we think about a city's perspective versus the county, certain health care services and programs, we need to look on a broad geographic basis. And level one trauma is one of those services. And that's why I made the statement, if we had a blank canvas, we'd probably place our five level one trauma centers in different locations. And there's not many that would argue that statement. But where we are, looking from a county perspective, we do have sufficient level one trauma if we just look countywide and ask how many level one trauma centers do we have. Again, are they in the right locations? I think most people would argue perhaps they're not. But again, I think if there's high interest in level one trauma, and that's really the purpose of this slide, is we're looking countywide. I think if there's interest in level one trauma, that would be a different study. You'd take a deeper dive.
I'm confused now because now you're saying you're looking countywide. Before, we are looking at the radius of this site. Are we looking at this site or are we looking countywide?
We're focused in this study on this site. My statement on level one trauma is if we were to do an actual population-based study on level one trauma, you need to pick a bigger geography than downtown Mesa or even the city of Mesa. We need to be looking broader.
Well, would it be accurate then to, so we can get off this because we can spend all morning on this, to say that, you know, it seems like it's a little bit over, I don't want to use the word overreach, but in a sense to specifically state, and I think where everyone's getting a little bit ruffled is the direct statement that don't even consider level one trauma for downtown. And that's probably what I'm hearing in the discussion, is probably jumping a little too far. We understand that trauma centers are extremely expensive. They're a very big investment. You have to have surrounding infrastructure. You look at downtown, even with the Arizona Regional Medical Center, you know, question as to whether that's sufficient to fully support. We understand that. But what you're saying, but what I'm hearing, though, is that if that infrastructure existed and if you could revisit it, it's not that a level one, no one would ever want to put a level one or would ever put one in there. It's just that you've taken an as-is look at things and said, hey, listen, if you came to me and said on this site at this day, we see issues with that.
That's correct.
That's a little bit less than absolutely no way would this ever work. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I completely agree with
that. If we can agree on that, then let's move on to the next one and two, or else we're going to be here all morning.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to cover some of the potential impacts of the provision on health care. Currently today, as we sit, there's a shortage of about 122 physicians in nearly every specialty practice in Mesa. The primary care shortfall is about 60%. Primary care includes family medicine, OBGYN, pediatrics. 20% of the shortfall is in the psychiatric area. Funding shortages that were identified through the state budgetary process was a cut of $42 million to fund graduate medical education. The outcome of that could be the potential of losing about 100 resident positions here in Arizona. Evidence has shown us that 20% of the physicians who train in Arizona stay in Arizona to practice medicine. And so some of the other challenges that are facing physician shortages or facilitating physician shortages in Arizona are access and insurance reimbursements. And the cost of practicing medicine can be, in some cases, dissuading physicians to stay or to relocate to the state of Arizona.
Lead council member Summers has a question.
The 20% retainment of physicians in Arizona, how does that compare nationally to other medical schools in their state?
It varies. It can be as high as 40% in certain cities.
Okay. So,
and in other areas, it's lower.
This is the state, so is it more than 40% in cities?
It can be, but
Pennsylvania keep more than that?
You know, we did not do a state-by-state look. Certainly could answer that for you. It does vary city by city. The exciting thing here for Arizona, and Mesa in particular, is we have very strong healthcare assets, and that makes physicians want to stay. So you're hitting about average at 20% for the United States.
Okay. For those states, what I'd be interested in is for those states who are have a higher retention of physicians following medical school, mm-hmm. what is it that helps retain them? Do they have resident positions that, unfortunately, we're losing because of state funding cuts?
Mm-hmm.
Do they have maybe medical grant programs for their education that requires them to, that if they stay for a certain period of time, they get to keep that money as a grant instead of a loan?
Mm-hmm.
Those would be interesting components of a strategy for the future.
The other piece would be reimbursement. We have to look at Medicaid reimbursement. That is a strong driver.
And I'm not familiar with this arena. Does that differ, Medicare reimbursement differ from state to state then?
Medicare does not, but Medicaid does, because Medicaid is state regulated at this point in time. That's
access
for us, correct?
Right.
Medicare, the difference with Medicare in certain states, as we all know, is Medicare varies state by state only based on the size of the population. So Arizona has a very high Medicare population. And unfortunately, in certain specialty areas, the reimbursement is quite low. And that's
why the practice. You have a higher percentage of Medicare patients than you might if you're in.
And that's why you'll see, if we were to compare the need for physicians here in the East Valley versus the West Valley, over in the West Valley, they actually have a greater deficit and a more difficult time recruiting physicians because of that high Medicare population.
Okay.
Just one thing jumps out at me. I mean, if Arizona cut 42 men, if we're only retaining 20% of our physicians, I wonder why you would invest $42 million if you're only going to get one out of five sticking around after you fund. But that's just a...
Well, with the chicken and egg, which came first?
Yeah.
Did they cut it and then...
I've already used that analogy.
Leaving.
You can only use that once a day.
Cart and a horse.
Okay, there you go. There you go. That's much better.
Well, you have the potential of attracting students to come to the graduate medical school, and perhaps with more critical mass, more of them will stay. So
let me ask you this. Maybe you're getting to this. Are we training enough doctors? I mean, we talk about retaining 20%. How many medical schools do we have in Arizona?
Well, we've got the University of Arizona that has two facilities now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. AT Still, Southwest, or whatever it is over in...
You have Midwestern.
Midwestern, not Southwestern, Midwestern.
Midwestern.
Are those the three or three and a half?
I believe so, unless we're missing a DO school somewhere.
Well, Midwestern and AT are both DOs.
Right, they're both DOs.
Okay. That would seem low for a state our size.
Absolutely. The short answer to your question, are we training enough doctors nationwide, is no.
And especially in Arizona, we're not.
Especially in Arizona, and in certain of these specialty areas, I'll pick on gastroenterology, general surgery.
Excuse me?
You
don't have to repeat it.
I'm not that awake. But we don't have enough residency slots.
Gotcha.
Even.
Okay. Councilmember Summers.
In looking at this entire study, one of the issues seems to be physician retention and education, and that would be a really nice component of any economic development strategy in healthcare. You had mentioned the DO colleges versus MD colleges. What's the significant difference in between the two, and would it matter? If we wanted, we're going to soon talk about education component downtown. If we wanted to make, trying to attract another medical school to Mesa, would it matter if it's MD or DO?
I would say today it matters less and less. In fact, what I was reading very recently for another client is that the DO schools are actually growing more in their student base than we're seeing in the allopathic schools. The major difference, and I don't want to pretend to understand everything that's different about osteopathic versus allopathic, is someone explained it to me, is that the osteopaths learn and are trained in all areas as our MDs, which are the allopaths, but they learn a little bit more. They also focus on the skeleton and the spine.
I think the real test is, previous, 20, 30 years ago, the big difference was they couldn't practice together.
Correct.
My understanding now is that, you know, there's virtually no differentiation.
Absolutely.
They work side by side. They get privileges at hospitals exactly the same. And that's the real, you know, can they work in the hospitals? You used to have DO hospitals.
Absolutely.
Now you have hospitals.
Correct.
And it seems to me like there's no practical difference between the two as far as when you walk into a hospital, you may get one or the other.
It's very true. I think as we think about healthcare reform, which is going to be pushing and focusing our healthcare system on wellness, primary care, DOs are very strong in that primary care arena.
Okay.
Which is one of the major shortfalls that you identify in the studies, so perhaps DO schools would fit really well in a strategic initiative toward healthcare education downtown.
Absolutely. Okay.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Sorry about that. Let's go ahead and move on.
All right. So as we think about the future, Mesa has a tremendous amount of healthcare assets in place today and certainly can become known for a center of excellence. The healthcare simulation training facility in Banner that's in existence today, the potential of partnership with MD Anderson, Pediatrics, Cardin's Children's Hospital that's locating in Banner, and of course you have A.T. Still University here in Mesa. So you've got those tremendous assets from which to build upon and leverage for future. We offer several recommendations to help strengthen Mesa's position within the healthcare arena. First and foremost, as we looked at that 25-acre parcel, we thought about the development of a healthplex. That would be a world-class medical center for health and wellness, which is certainly a focus of healthcare reform. And to have that expertise in downtown, which could become a focal point and serve as a critical mass to attract additional health care. Healthplex brings together those physician offices, diagnostics equipment, healthy restaurants and spas, and the whole goal is to keep people healthy and to keep people out of the hospital. Secondly is to work with MD Anderson. MD is scheduled to open the fall of 2011 at the Banner Gateway Medical Center, which is just directly across the street from the city of Mesa in Gilbert. And there's the potential to help develop that commercial infrastructure that will be needed, such as hotels and office and restaurants. MD Anderson is set to attract startup companies, bioscience startups, clinical research, and other cancer-related vendors will be attracted to that area. So that could become, if you will, a healthcare corridor, you know, for the cities of Mesa and Gilbert. And then thirdly is to partner with Banner as it relates to the simulation center. The simulation center that Banner has is one of the largest in the world, and currently they're training just their own physicians. And so there's the potential to broaden and expand that mission that Banner currently has by attracting physicians from outside of Arizona, outside of the U.S., you know, to train within this Banner simulation facility. It can also become the local testing for new clinical devices. And so in short, there's the potential for medical tourism to take place within the city of Mesa. And Banner certainly can be a catalyst in making that happen. So partnering with Banner to sit down and facilitate those discussions to figure out what the future could hold for the potential of broadening and expanding that mission. There's certainly a role that Mesa could play within the development of that.
Councilmember Higgins has a question.
I just didn't understand these recommendations. The report was like for downtown, but these things are citywide.
These are broader.
Yeah, okay. Some of these are broader. These were other strategies and ideas that came to the forefront.
For example, even though Gateway and MD Anderson is right across the line, to the east of Higley is all Mesa.
Sure.
And that big chunk of property right at the freeway is in Mesa, so right. You know, there's things we can do.
So we just looked at, we started off downtown and then we just spread out to the rest of Mesa.
Correct. Yeah, we did. We the asset inventory was regional. The physician and beds gap analysis was based on the socio-demographics of the trade area from the downtown area. And then as interviews were conducted with various healthcare providers and hospital representatives, other opportunities bubbled to the top, and
you're pointing out
part.
Opportunities we have in other areas of the city citywide.
Right.
Councilman Richens?
A lot of people may not be aware that Banner already is bringing in outside groups to the Sim Center.
They started that?
For training. Yeah, they've done that already. Yeah. That a friend of mine who works for He's
that's
doing
just recent then.
An intern at St. Joe's Hospital in Phoenix came. They sent all their physicians out to the Banner facility to do a couple days worth of training. So
we've sort of gone full circle because when they first started, they were even going to team up with Mace Community and other things, and they went back totally inside. So that's good.
Right. I think they recognize the opportunity that you guys have stated, and they're underway on that already.
They do. I would say.
Go right ahead.
I was just going to make a comment regarding that. You're absolutely right. They have started bringing in other physicians, but they could take it even bigger. And with the virtual environments that we have today, that could lend itself well to Banner Simulation Center as well. We have some examples over actually in Europe where we see these training centers that have become world-renowned in laparoscopic surgery, for instance, a very small niche perhaps, but that one area of France brings physicians from all over the world for the latest training, and that could be the same for Banner Simulation
Center. They look for things like that. Councilmember Summers? Okay. Go ahead.
Moving on to some other strategies to consider for building your healthcare cluster here in Mesa. I certainly want to have you consider cultivating those existing relationships with those healthcare providers to help them accelerate their expansion plans, AT Still University, IASIS, and Cardins. In particular, with Cardins, their Cardins currently services local patients and families, and their goal was with the next 3 to 5 years. To expand that to service patients and families in adjacent states. So there may be an opportunity for Mesa to work with Banner to help them develop that and expand that. Fourth on the list is continuing to foster your relationship with the Mayo Clinic and their aerospace program, the potential for partnership at the Mesa Air Force Research Lab at Gateway Airport is a tremendous opportunity and can be a real catalyst for other types of research and development that could take place within that field. And then lastly, as you mentioned earlier, strengthen the supply of physicians, offering those medical grants to physicians and have them establish their practice here in Mesa with the requirement that they practice medicine here for so many years in exchange for that grant for medical school. Okay. Yeah, to help shape the future, want to cultivate these local opportunities to help build a 21st century healthcare city for Mesa, looking at the next generation healthcare. And this would require integrating the personal health portals, the medical fitness, the wellness facilities, outpatient and medical training, and all of those centers of excellence, having that embodied within a healthcare city within Mesa. Partnering with local health care providers is certainly the approach that has worked with other cities that have done this and helped develop that medical infrastructure. And so those are kind of the high-level vision for where Mesa could possibly take this. Models that you could study, certainly Lake Nona Medical Center out of Florida, Nashville, Tennessee Healthcare Council Development, and then Minneapolis Life Sciences Corridor. The Lake Nona Medical Center started out as a 7,000-acre master plan development that embodied healthcare as an anchor. And today, as they stand, they've got Burnham Institute for Medical Research, their East Coast campus, which opened in 2009. They've got MD Anderson Cancer Research Institute located within Lake Nona. The University of Florida Research Facility is scheduled to open in 2012. And then the University of Central Florida College of Medicine and Science campus is also scheduled to open within Lake Nona. So that's a really good case study to copy and to learn from their best practices and how they made that happen. The second one is the Nashville, Tennessee.
Hey, Judy, I think Councilmember Summers has a question.
Lake, what was it, Lake?
Lake Nona.
Lake Nona. That was a, you mentioned that was master plan.
That was
That was the Disney World of healthcare, if you will. A bad analogy, but to get to my point, they took marshland and created Disney World out of it. In this case, they took marshland and created a healthcare center out of that. Mm-hmm. What was the public investment in that? What was the community, state and local community investment in that? Do you know?
In terms of dollars and cents?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know what the dollars and cents are. I know that there certainly were some public-private partnerships that were devised to help facilitate the attraction of these amenities to the area. They had a vision to start with in terms of what the direction was that they wanted to go, and they partnered with, you know, more than one.
It was a public-private partnership, but there was significant investment in that community to in order to bring in those high-wage jobs and make that work. Do we have any idea what that was?
I don't have.
When Mesa brought TGen in there, there was a lot of jobs created on that. TGen does a lot of that bio research.
Right.
They also brought Phoenix. Phoenix, did I say Mesa? I'm sorry. If Mesa had done that, it would have been wonderful. Phoenix had brought in TGen. There's a lot of high-wage jobs there. They also brought in the University of Arizona Health Center. Go Devils. Second.
How much would it cost to create a marshland?
How much marshland? I'm getting to my point.
Create a marshland.
They scraped desert in downtown Phoenix to create these. There was public-private partnership. There's public investment in that. Do we know how much that was?
Mayor and Councilmember Summers, if I may, on the Florida model, the reason we looked at that in particular was because it was attractive to a couple of healthcare assets that we have here in Mesa. And in terms of just one of the projects that located there, the Burnham Institute, when I was at the Department of Commerce, we were working to attract that facility here in Arizona. We worked with the Flynn Foundation and partners locally, GPEC as well. But the state of Florida actually gave the Burnham Institute $100 million to locate.
And ours is cutting.
In Florida, correct. And actually, they signed an exclusive with them, so Burnham can't expand any further. They have an East Coast and a West Coast now.
I wasn't going to be targeting that one specifically, but... But
well, and TGen, you brought up as an example, that is a good example of the City of Phoenix investment and how they brought in county and state partners to fund that. If I recall, they built the facility for TGen. They also awarded them grants, and the state has given them $30 million probably over the last 5 years. So those are examples and cases that we can look at as to what it takes to build things like that.
So we put together some interesting strategies for they're really just a foundation for possible strategic initiative or a plan. We haven't done the plan yet.
Right.
But Phoenix invested. There was a public-private partnership. Florida is invested. What does Mesa have to throw to the table? If we're going to move forward with phase two, which is going to be one of the recommendations of putting together a plan, what does Mesa have to bring to the table to make a private partner want to invest in this community?
Well, aren't we sort of jumping way ahead of the thing? We haven't even decided. I mean, I understand where you're getting at, and eventually that's going to be there, but it seems to me like we're jumping. We haven't even heard or listen to what a possible strategy may be. There's no doubt we're not going to throw $100 million. And I question whether we even should be thinking that way, because there are other assets we have in place. Mm-hmm. There's relationships we have in place. And at a time, I get where you're going, but let's come back to this, because I think that there's an interim step that talks about what we can do as a community to identify potential opportunities, and then we'll come back to
Another model that you might want to study is Nashville. You know, Nashville created a healthcare council in 1995, and it's an association of healthcare industry representatives in partnership with the city. And over that time frame, they've located 56 healthcare companies to the community, and the overall economic development benefit that they've estimated is $30 million. With 210,000 jobs. So there's other approaches, you know, as you start looking at different models of other parts of the country and internationally as well. There are different approaches that you can take. Not all of them have to have a big, you know, ticket price tag associated with it. Minneapolis identified a life sciences corridor within their community, which is about a mile and a half long. Mm-hmm. And they've partnered with physicians and healthcare providers and research institutes and the city. And so their approach was taking, you know, an area within their community and identifying it as their healthcare corridor and working with the local healthcare providers and attracting the investment that's needed in order to make that corridor viable. Mm-hmm. That corridor is adjacent to their research their medical research industrial park. And so there's some synergies that take place in that particular environment. So those are potential models to study. The components that drive success, again, are obviously public-private partnerships to help facilitate healthcare and that cluster development. A unified vision and overall strategy, as you mentioned, Councilman Summers, is really very important to help drive those next steps so that you're strategic in your approach and you know where you're going and you know what you have to spend and what you can do. A university or college as an anchor is also a common thread that runs throughout these models that we looked at, as well as the presence of clinical research. So those are the components that will help drive success as you go forward and think about your next phase. Next steps, you know, the strategy needs to be ingrained in your economic development plan. Preparing that long-term healthcare strategy will help the city build upon your healthcare assets that we've currently identified within the community and begin implementing some of those recommendations. A consideration of perhaps creating a staff position that can help focus and has a specialty in that particular industry, because the industry is very, very broad. When you start to dissect the healthcare industry, there's various aspects to it. And having somebody who has that specialty and understanding in that market, I think, could help facilitate your early success in the future. And then analyze that marketability of the 25-acre parcel in your downtown area for redevelopment. Is a healthplex, you know, feasible for that particular location? And so how will the city move forward as it relates to that? And so that concludes the presentation, and we certainly are available to answer any additional questions or respond to any more comments.
I guess to summarize some, because if I'm trying to synthesize into a very quick explanation from your study, what you're saying is Mesa has an impressive asset of healthcare facilities, and we have several hospitals, many of which are less than 5 years old. There's been, and what we didn't put here is the recent investment in healthcare facilities, which is well over $1 billion in Mesa, and if you throw Gateway in there, Banner Gateway, it even adds to it, and that might as well be Mesa. We'll share with Gilbert this year with us. That's fine. But what we don't have, and we have a medical school that's actually doing an incredible job at creating a cutting-edge education. What we don't have, and what we're going to need if we want to develop downtown or any other area of the city, because I think what you've stated is that there are other opportunities, pockets of opportunity throughout the city because of these assets we have. But in order to really take advantage of those, we need to identify that this is a strategy that goes beyond just identifying what we call our heat. Mm-hmm. You know, it's great to say healthcare is a nice asset that we're going to build upon. Okay, how do we focus in on that and create a specific plan? Now, hopefully that specific plan would include assets we have in downtown. You know, we do have a hospital. Yep. You know, it may not be Banner Children's, but Arizona Regional Medical Center has done a great job with the assets they have, and they have a very aggressive management group. We do have property. We do have things like light rail. The question is, how can we develop a healthcare? What you're saying is the opportunities for healthcare as a significant driver in our local economy are there. Mm-hmm. Am I correct
in
that?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
We have a variety of assets. Whether they fit in downtown or not, if I'm hearing you right, really depends upon our specific strategy and our ability to maybe coalesce some of these assets together and sell them on the potential of our specific downtown assets and sites. Right. To create this health city, mm-hmm. we need to focus more and put more of our resources toward fine-tuning that approach and making a specific approach that relates to a specific thing in healthcare. Is that a mm-hmm. okay summary of what you said?
It is. It's a good summary of what we see in Mesa. The exciting thing that Judy and I see in Mesa from a healthcare perspective is you have great, strong assets, and that then lends itself to starting to think bigger in terms of healthcare.
So we need to build upon those.
Right.
Absolutely.
Versus a Lake Nona or if we went out to Dubai and some of these other international markets that did take a...
And Lake Nona had a great plan, but what they did, as Councilmember Summers said, they created a master plan, and they threw a heck of a lot of money at it.
They did.
You don't
they,
have
they,
to
they
go
They basically bought their way into it. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that we don't have that.
Yeah.
But what they didn't have that we do have is that we have a built-in established base, and it's not only an established base, but it's a new base. Mm-hmm. I mean, with Banner Children's, with MD Anderson, with the Sim Center, all these are relatively new things, and so these are cutting edge type of things. And so we have that where Lake Nona doesn't have. Somehow we got to figure out a way to take the poor boy approach, which is okay because we can get there, but it's a little bit more challenging. But we're working from a better base. Mm-hmm. And hopefully then we can get to where Councilmember Summers and I have had a lot of discussion on this, where we have this closing fund or whatever we call it. We have the financial resources that we can seal the deal after we build upon this, that's the real limiting factor we have, is that we don't have a seal the deal. We don't have the $100 million that we're going to throw out. And maybe we shouldn't have that at all. Maybe there's a better way of doing that, and we can attract this specialty stuff. Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely. And I also think, looking even at a Phoenix versus a Mesa, Mesa's opportunity is greater than a Phoenix. Phoenix has so many other competing entities involved, and I think that's why we're looking at TGen that's done very well, but it's not going the next steps. So,
I think one of the things we have in Mesa that Phoenix doesn't have is that we need to get our so-called regional and state. Mm-hmm. Mr. Brady, I'm climbing up on a soapbox. You better get me down. I mean, it's a little upsetting when we have regional and other groups that completely bypass and don't even talk about downtown Mesa mm-hmm. with the assets it has, but they talk about downtown Phoenix.
Correct.
I've heard of instances where interested parties and even out-of-state hospitals and universities have come in and were shown one site, and that's downtown mm-hmm. Phoenix. And, you know, downtown Mesa... is the only pure downtown we'll have on the light rail line. There's many assets that we have. Mm-hmm. And it would be nice to even be in the game, to be even allowed the opportunity to develop that. So I guess we just got to work a little bit harder. We got to scream a little bit louder, and we got to let people know we're here, because the natural tendency is to pass us over. And I'm not whining, I'm just stating a fact. That's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. And, we had a out-of-state university in the valley recently, and we found out just by a scuttlebutt that they were looking for places to locate. This was non-medical related, and our wonderful gatekeepers, I would say, didn't even mention Mesa. We got on the screen because I picked up the phone and called the university president. And when they came in town, they were amazed at what they saw. Mm-hmm. And you know that happens time and time again. But now I'm whining. I've switched from just soapbox to whining. But we got to work harder. The fact matter is, we just got to work harder. We got to do better. We don't have the money. We got assets, though. We've got great
assets.
Absolute assets, and we just have to take advantage of those and figure out a way to work harder and do it better. And what I'm hearing here, and frankly, I don't know what we were expecting. I guess this, in many ways, you'll see it. The expectations were a little bit different, but I don't think that's bad, because I think what you've identified for us is that we do have assets that we can build upon. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's more citywide assets than downtown specific assets, but I think we're seeing a way that we can bring these together to create downtown opportunities mm-hmm. based on what we have. But we have a few hurdles we have to get over. One of them is the one I just mentioned, and the other one is what Councilmember Summers mentioned. We just don't have a big bank account that we can throw, and like I said, I think that's okay, because we can make it up other ways, or at least try to make it up other ways.
So
we have to make it up other ways, because we don't have the other one.
No choice. So our next step is to come back with a itemized budget, talking about a comprehensive strategy and a business development plan, and really start to lay out what it's going to take to get to the next step, very focused on healthcare specific.
Well, I love the idea of the what'd you call it, the health city?
Yep.
The HealthPlex, those kind of things, where I think we can sell a vision that's specifically targeted to a subcomponent or a specific opportunity that we have based on the existing asset base or based on opportunities in the overall market. I think that's what we really need to do, Bill, is rather than say we have a position, that doesn't do a whole lot for me. I know if we get five people involved in this, but I want to know where they should focus. I want to know where our specific opportunities are when you take into account MD Anderson, Banner Children, the Sim Center, the fact that we have property here, the fact that we have our power road, our power knowledge corridor, and we have existing assets. How do we focus those into a real opportunity? And I can see a way where if we create a specific vision for a downtown, for example, we can then get people to thinking that, and we can create that opportunity. But that's what I'd like to see when you're looking at budgeting. Also talk about what this person would focus on and how they would define and implement a vision and a strategy.
I think laying out that strategy and that plan, I'm not focused on a position, I'm just focused on what the cost and the budgeting for that whole strategy is going to be. And that's what we'll bring back the next time.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Okay. Now we're going to move on to the presentation and which discusses in higher education opportunities.
After that last one,
and now that we're awake, we'll try to be a lot more efficient in this one. So, if you want to just skip to the summary, that might be.
They don't look very happy about walking up here.
He said this would be easy.
You guys ready?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Good. Okay, so now we're on to the findings and recommendations of the Higher Education Feasibility Study and Recruitment Strategy. It was also funded with Community Development Block Grant in fiscal year 2010 and focused on the downtown area for their primary research parameters, and I'm sure Sarah will get into some details here in a second. But please keep in mind the study is considered the initial phase of improving the redevelopment area. The long-term goals, again, creating high-quality jobs, injecting some new capital, and revitalizing downtown. The project also included an economic impact analysis based on likely scenarios for downtown. They developed a higher education recruitment strategy and an outline of what will need to happen in the next step. Again, Jay O'Donnell is from the Office of Economic Development, was the project manager on the study. Tri-Advocates is here to present those findings, who partnered with Applied Economics to fulfill the work. So let me start with introducing John Kelly, a principal of Tri-Advocates. Prior to his current position, John held leadership roles with Intel Corp, the state of Arizona, the Arizona Board of Regents, and worked for an Arizona member of Congress in Washington. Julie Reese is also here with Tri-Advocates. She specializes in economic development. Her roots go back to the 70s in Mesa. She served in the Mesa 2025 plan and has worked in municipal government prior to joining Tri-Advocates. Sarah Murley is here as an economist and a partner with Applied Economics, a Phoenix-based consulting firm specializing in economic development, economic and fiscal impact analysis, socioeconomic modeling, and urban planning. With that, John, it's all yours.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Mayor and Council. It's an honor to be here with my colleagues, Julie Reese, who's hiding in the audience but not too far away, and Sarah Murley, to discuss the report we prepared on your behalf regarding recruitment of higher education institutions to Arizona, particularly to the city of Mesa. The fundamental conclusion of the work that we performed is that recruiting additional higher education resources to the city of Mesa is feasible, desirable, and likely to result in many direct and indirect benefits to this community. It would be impossible, really, to do justice to the level of details in the report in the short time we have, and I know you've had an opportunity to be briefed on it. We tried, basically, to look at this question from as many different angles as we possibly could, and I think we've done a very thorough job of that, particularly with Sarah's analytical work, and I'm glad that she's here to provide some of that to you. We sought feedback from a diverse array of your community members, private sector leaders, educators, and even students, a significant number of those, to get their attitudes and perspective. We did some education of those, and we conducted some facilitated sessions. We did surveys. We did a variety of different things to add what I thought was a lot of significant color to the report. Sarah conducted extensive research into various aspects of the higher education market, its feasibility and its potential economic impacts. And our report, we believe, has given you a roadmap first to understand where we are today and probably more importantly, a methodology for moving forward should the council so choose. To get into the slides a bit, this is a bit of a snapshot at where we are with current enrollment in public universities and community colleges in the state of Arizona. A significant number. We also have hundreds of what we call the private technical technical non-degree granting training associated private colleges. We also have 10 degree granting colleges at the moment, and some of those are Mesa based. What's interesting about this is that when you look at this number, there's been significant growth over the last 20 years in this enrollment number, and obviously those of us in the shadow of ASU have seen growth there and in the community college system. But every single one of the growth projections that has been prepared over the last 20 years has far underestimated the actual growth and enrollment that's occurred in those communities. Let me see, where were we? I got a little ahead of myself here. We also did a little bit of comparison. I think we've lost a slide here, so that's all right. Sarah did an estimate of potential undergraduate students, particularly those that might be interested in going to a private college. We have done extensive work at looking at the market in Arizona for higher education, and what we found is that Arizona is extremely well served in public higher education, again, the university system and the community college system. We also have greater than average percentage of population participating in private non-traditional education, the University of Phoenix, the DeVry, that Western International, those kinds of institutions. When Sarah looked at this question 5 years ago, what she found is we lagged peer communities in the percentage of population enrolled in private traditional colleges. It was about 3.1% at the time. It's now over 10%, and that's within a very short five-year time frame. I think that's a pretty remarkable statistic, but it also speaks to the demand that is occurring for higher education in our community, some of the resources that are available. And this data provides some insight into what we perceive to be a potential pool of undergraduate students that this community can tap into in the near future. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, these numbers aren't huge, and the demand for private higher education versus public higher education is always going to be smaller, but this is only demand within Arizona. So to the extent that you had a school that drew people in, and you know, Arizona is an attractive place to come and go to college, and so to the extent that you were drawing in people from outside the state, it would be bigger than what we're showing here.
Exactly. Thank you. These are just a couple of other data points that we believe are anecdotal but could support the hypothesis that Arizona has unmet need. And I know that there's been extensive work been done over the last several years, including by the governor's office. She had a commission on higher education, and this data comes from that, from other sources.
Councilmember Summers has a question.
Ma'am, on your last point, you said that that pool was rather small. It was about 24,000. One of your data sets on page 14, figure 3, seems to demonstrate that the units, well, at least for Arizona State University and NAU, 80% of the students are in state. So does that mean we can anticipate another 20% over this number, or do you think that number is actually higher for privates, if this were a private school?
I think with private schools, you're more likely to attract out-of-state students because you don't have the differential in tuition.
Okay. So the pool could be anywhere from 26,000 to anywhere to who knows.
Okay. It's hard to say because we haven't, in the past, we have not historically positioned ourselves as a state where students come to go to private college. We haven't had a lot of private colleges. So
yeah, the private schools I've talked to, as a matter of fact, even in California, the majority of their students are not local residents.
Mm-hmm.
They're
mm-hmm.
out of state, certainly out of area.
Right, right.
They come in and live. They're resident. They're not commuters.
Exactly, right. And that's the.
And that, like you said, that's a nature, because all of a sudden now you're comparable or to out of state tuition at an ASU or U of A, and so.
Right.
Like you said, the cost differential is minimal.
And that essentially is the point of this current slide, which talks about the out-of-state tuition cost at ASU relative to some of the other tuition costs from some of the other private schools that
we have to plead a little bit ignorance to this. Collins College? Is it's tech school? I'm just not familiar with that one.
Arts, yeah.
Yeah, it used to be called the Al Collins School of Graphic Design. Now it's called Collins College.
Gotcha. I know all the others on there, but not Collins.
It's been around for quite some time, and it has a very superb reputation, as does the University of Advancing Technology.
Yeah,
and it attracts
a
lot of
out-of-state
people.
With the technology, but not with Collins. Okay, thank you.
For the next several slides, I'd like to defer to Sarah to talk a little bit about her methodology and the economic impacts associated with what could occur. Sarah.
Okay. So we're changing gears a little bit, and we looked at three potential pro formas and what the economic impacts of those would be, specifically in the city of Mesa. And we chose these particular pro formas because at the time that we did this, these were actual active prospects. So we looked at a law school, and in a second I'll get to the assumptions that we used, and then we looked at an arts college in both a residential format and a non-residential format. And the economic impacts that we're looking at here are made up of the school themselves. They're, in addition to being an education provider, they're of course also an employer, and they function, you know, they have payroll and they function as a business as well. So there are those direct impacts. There's also student spending, and we only looked at student spending associated with people who were primarily students. So if you're a part-time student and you also have a job and you just happen to be going to school, your spending is really more associated with your being a worker than being a full-time student. But to the extent that there are more full-time students, which in the case of the law school, they require you to be a full-time student. In the case of the arts college, if it's residential, we're assuming that you're a full-time student. If it's not a residential campus, we did a 50-50 split between full-time students and part-time students. So if students are full-time, they're more likely to spend locally. If students are living on campus, obviously they're somewhat restricted to spending more locally. The other things, components that we looked at here are institutional spending by the schools, which is proportional to their size, but they buy office supplies, they buy utilities, they buy printing services, you know, variety of things that colleges can buy from local suppliers. And so there's spin-off activity there that supports additional jobs and production locally. And then the final component that we looked at was visitor spending. And really that has to do with more the nature of the school. Do they offer a lot of, say, seminars to businesses that bring in people from outside the area? Do they have, if they're an arts, a performance-oriented school, do they have performances that bring in people from outside the area? Various other events that might bring in people for multiple days. So that's a component that we made some assumptions about here. And you can see that the law school, because it's its size, had the biggest impact, followed by the residential campus, and then the non-residential campus. So on the next slide, you can see the assumptions here. And the law school, and these were, you know, based on the actual figures for these particular schools, but would have an enrollment of about 500 people, students, about 15% of them. It's a regional campus. Only about 15% of them might live in Mesa. The arts college, the residential, obviously they would all live here. And then the no-dorm, non-residential scenario, we assumed that half of them were part-time commuting in from somewhere else and half of them were living here. The student spending is proportional to the number of students and the share of students that are full-time. On the employment, I accidentally flip-flopped the law school and the arts college without dorms. So the law school has about 98 staff people, some of them part-time. The arts college has the same number of staff, whether it's a residential campus or not. We're assuming about 15 teaching staff there, and we made some assumptions about payroll because that feeds into the economic impact. On the construction costs, in this case, the law school was looking at constructing a brand new facility and fairly large to accommodate 500 students. The arts college, there was an existing building they could use for classroom space due to tenant improvements on it. If they needed dorms, then that was going to be a new additional component of the construction, so you can see the differential in construction costs. The next slide shows the construction impacts, and these are non-recurring, but it's a substantial amount of construction. And you can see in the law, K the law school, it's a bigger school, it's brand new, so there's more construction activity there. Obviously, the dorms are going to add a greater component to the construction, too. But there are non-recurring but not insignificant benefits to the construction activity as well.
And I think the underlying point is these were designed to be very realistic and conservative estimates of impact based on actual situations, and we weren't just making things up based on wishful thinking, and we thought that was a responsible approach. We wanted to give you a quick bit of feedback on the outreach that we performed with the community, and there are some major themes that came out of that that we found very useful to our work. There certainly was strong support for additional higher education options in this region, and that private institutions were thought to be perhaps the right thing at the right time. Higher education was also desired to complement the existing economic development strategies of the city, and there was a keen interest in particular in filling some of the current programmatic voids in terms of professions that maybe the universities are attempting to cover, or that there's demand that's outpacing the supply of those programs. And I know the report provides some extensive information, both look backward looking at the fastest growing occupations over the last decade, and also some speculation about some of the emerging programs like health information technology, electronic medical records, that are considered highly desirable and with talent in short supply, and frankly programs in short supply to meet those demands. So we got very good insight from employers and frankly from educators about what the state and what the region is doing pretty well, where the demand is so great, and what we need to do to meet it. And that's why private higher education was considered sort of an entrepreneurial way to respond to some of those issues. Other relevant findings include the fact that Greater Phoenix, as I mentioned before, is a leader in the percentage of older populations seeking higher education. This is what we call the non-traditional student, the above age 24 to 64 group. And we've also seen, as I said, the huge growth in enrollment as a percentage of population in private traditional, tripling as a percentage of population over a very short period of time. And also the fact that Mesa has, and the East Valley, frankly, has a higher than average percentage of adults with college attainment, which is deemed to be an indicator of children that are going to be interested in achieving, desiring higher education. That is not true for the state as a whole, but it is true for Mesa and the East Valley in terms of serving your current population needs as opposed to recruiting from other places. We also heard loud and clear that the existing public institutions are highly valued, incredibly important assets and contributors to our community, and that they need to be involved in this conversation in an appropriate way, and they have been. And we heard very good feedback. We heard feedback of all kinds, but we did hear feedback from several educators that higher education options needed to be more diversified, even if it meant that not from their institution. We also heard the opposite. But it was important to recognize in this current fiscal environment the public institutions are facing a great deal of stress. Their ability to respond to demand in programs is challenged because of the state's fiscal environment, and so that does create, in some ways, an opportunity for private higher education. And finally, we also heard from a number of people that demographics are destiny, and that the long-term growth prospects for this region continue to be very positive despite the current recession. And that relative to other parts of the country where the long-term prospects for growth are nil or negative, we can be an attractive place for existing institutions to perhaps put a foot in a higher growth region. So that was considered an attractive part of our strategy. I put this up in the presentation because I thought it was interesting. It indicates that there is a demand for private higher education among Arizona students, and in this two cases, data from Mesa Public Schools and from Brophy College Preparatory for the class of 2010, if students are seeking private higher education, they're going out of state to find it.
Now, are they going out of state? I mean, that's a statement of a fact. or data.
It's a data point.
The question is why. Are they going out of state because limited opportunity here? Or are they going out of state because regardless of what's here, they want to go out of state? Or, I mean, because that I think right. that's key for whether this is worth the effort to pursue. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could attract five private colleges here to downtown if students just want to go out of state because they want to get away. Doesn't do us a whole lot of good.
There's certainly a cohort of that group that would like to, and I count my kids as among them. They want to get out of state, not because they don't love us, but because they see better opportunities for the kinds of programs they want, the desirability of the programs they want in other places, plus they want that adventure. But there was also a significant...
Well, let's get back to what you're saying, though. What you're saying is we really can't tell. The question is, if those programs existed in state, you have the adventure aspect, but how can you draw a conclusion that they would still go out of state? I mean,
I can't draw that conclusion. What I can look to is some of the survey data we did, which was not scientific survey, but it was a viral survey we did, and we got feedback from a number of different students. I think it was 300 current high school students and about 150 current college students talking about their decision-making and what their preferences were. There was some desire for participation or attendance to a faith-based institution. And we have faith-based institutions here, but we do not have an LDS institution here, and we don't have a Catholic institution here. And the report talks about some of the demographics in our community that speak to a desire on the part of either children or their parents to attend faith-based institutions. So that would be another piece of the,
which
of
is,
the puzzle.
Which, contrary to many public opinion or misunderstanding, the Catholics make up by far the largest religious group in Mesa, mm-hmm. About twice as many as the next closest. So, Councilmember Summers.
Mayor, on your point, that goes back to what we had discussed earlier about what exactly is the potential out-of-state draw. Is it 20% as ASU draws about 20% of their students from out-of-state, or is it larger than that? Because if our students are leaving because they want to change a scenery, there are 49 other states. Almost screwed that one up. You said there's adult education? Might need remedial. 49 other states where students want to change the scenery too, and the desert Southwest may be just that type of scenery. So there's a market. What's also appealing about that, by the way, is that those students will be moving to Arizona and need to be housed somewhere. And it strikes me as that what we really want to do, if we want to create something special downtown, use education as a foundation for revitalizing downtown, then we need to have students and even some professors living and working and playing and learning in the downtown area. And if they need to be housed, they'll be here. DeVry, the Art Institute, your Collins College, University of Phoenix, all fine schools, but they don't do anything for economic redevelopment because their students live at home, and then they drive in, they take a class, or worse, sometimes the alternative education seems to be online learning, which I'm not a huge fan of. But you don't get the vibrancy of a Mill Avenue or a downtown Phoenix or Harvard Yard when students are on their computer somewhere distant. So it's the ability to bring students in outside the region and have them living in downtown, I think, needs to be an important component of anything we try to do in a downtown education plan.
Councilmember Finter.
I'm going to give you a response from a dad that spends a fortune on higher education right now. It's going to lack sophistication. There's a lot of, we're at the academic level here. How to best say it? Everything I'm reading so far, I knew. And I know from having tons of summertime kids home from college in my house and talking to them about these issues. And again, I'm spending money in another community in another state to try and get my children with their higher education. Get a little frustrated. My perspective would be that we lack some of those private institutions. The reality should be, and again, here's where the lack of sophistication, we need to have someone go over to the Catholic diocese, get a delegation and fly to Notre Dame and tell them, what is it going to take? What is it going to take? Here we have this asset. Mm-hmm. We're looking at spending millions on the tourism part of heat. Mm-hmm. What is it going to take to get an institution of your caliber here in this community? Mm-hmm. And no more studies, you know, no more academic discussions. We need, and I appreciate hearing the mayor getting on the phone and starting to call folks. And I probably am not aware of all those great efforts that are going on. I'm sure they are there. But if there was a clear message to send from a dad who's spending a fortune on higher education, I would love to at least have the benefit of having my children back here, receiving that education, keeping my dollars here, making Mesa a better place. So that's my emotional outburst for today. Wow. Thanks.
That was emotional.
Councilman, I feel your pain at the moment.
And thank you for that emotional outburst. No, but the Councilman Fender makes a lot of good points. The fact is this, just so everyone understands, there are efforts going on. Believe me, I have spent a lot of time on the phone. We've also had visits from out-of-state private education institutions who have spent time in our downtown. We have a study, as in most government endeavors, to try and focus on whether the resources that we are going to provide on a formal basis, because most of the work we've done so far has been informal. We identified heat. I've taken it as a personal thing, but that's informal. That doesn't have the concerted backing of this council or the Mesa city government, simply because we haven't had the basis from which to work. I guess that maybe we need to get our expectations in line with these studies. I hope these studies tell us that it's worth going after. Now, if they tell us that, then I hope that the next step is that we fine-tune and institutionalize what we are doing now on a onesie-twosie basis. And I agree with Councilmember Fenter. I would, as a matter of fact, haven't gone to the Catholics yet, but I have talked to LDS. I have talked to private colleges. We have talked to art schools. We have talked to a lot of people who are out of state, but it has not had the backing of a formal institutional process, which is what we need to do to get to that next step. So I agree with you 100%. And as unsophisticated as you think yours was, it was incredibly sophisticated, because it cuts to the core and gets to the matter of what we really need to do. Mm-hmm. So I hope we don't read too much or too little into these studies, because if these don't provide us with a foundation and tell us where we should go, then we've missed the boat. But on the other hand, I think most of the things in some studies, I'm glad that it does confirm what we already thought. Mm-hmm. Right. Because it tells us that our gut instincts that we've been based on so far are legitimate. And that they should be more focused. Councilmember Higgins, we need that line that we have upstairs. Councilmember Higgins,
hard to follow Councilmember Fincher's passionate plea, but as a mother of a college student and when going into college, and I teach at a high school occasionally, the thing I hear a lot, of course, it's all anecdotal. They don't like the big schools available here, so not everyone's ready to go into a school with 40,000 kids. Even, so all our big state institutions are huge. So I that's what I hear. We don't want to go to anything that big. But, that big might mean only 10,000, and that's a small school for them. So we're not looking at the 200-person school, but
well,
not
the average liberal arts college is anywhere from 1,000 to really 3,000. 4,000 is big for a liberal arts college.
So it's that lack
and even
of
Harvard and right. Yale, I think Yale only has what? 4,000 undergraduate students. Even the so-called Ivy League have very small.
So it's that lack of that in-between school. There's not, from the community college to the massive university, there's not just a college to choose from. So that's why I see all my kids' friends mm-hmm. going out of state for that smaller, medium-sized liberal arts college.
They don't have the option.
It's not here.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. I want to demonstrate the benefits of having an old-timer on the city council, because there's no one sitting at this table or in this room that was here in a leadership position in 1997 and 1998. This issue was something that we recognized a long time ago, and the city of Mesa made a very concerted effort to recruit Lewis University from Illinois to Mesa. Lewis University is a Christian Brothers college outside, has campuses all throughout Illinois and in Chicago, because, again, we understood the issue of a faith-based community. We had great support from the community. In fact, Mayor Brown led actually a majority of the council and assistant city manager to Illinois to a site visit to recruit. The city made an offer of leased land west of Falcon Field, the Orange Grove area, to Lewis University at very reasonable rates. And the reason we focused on working with Lewis is that they have a very strong aviation program. And with Mesa's interest in aviation, they wanted to be here and like the idea of Falcon Field and Gateway. We told them that the 202 would be coming to Falcon Field and that we had working to accelerate it, but of course that was one of those times where they couldn't see it because they couldn't get to the 202, obviously stopped a lot short of Falcon Field at that time. And we worked on it for a long time. There was support from the diocese in Phoenix. Unfortunately, we had a developer, shame and shocking, on the extreme west side of the valley in the Estrella Mountains who offered 160 acres free to Lewis University to consider locating there despite it, the fact that it was out in the middle of nowhere, at least at that time. But that that was an example, again, of Mesa did all the work, and they didn't get support, unfortunately, from regional or state entities. I know you're shocked at that. And I think that proposal foundered at the time because I think the school wanted to have a significant amount of money raised in Arizona before moving here. But clearly, I think the report substantiates what many people believe, that there is a need for faith-based institutions in Arizona. And Mesa was actually one of the leaders in that effort under Mayor Brown. And we worked for nearly a year to make that happen. And we got close. And so I think the conclusions and recommendations provide a good pathway for us that Mesa does have a lot of opportunities for educational institutions that to work on the strengths that we have with regard to our HEAT initiative, whether it is healthcare or aviation-based or hospitality or tourism-based. There are many educational institutions that have programs like that that can grow them. And there's a clear trend among colleges and universities to have multiple campuses at areas both to get students in or to retain students. They become assets for those universities. And so I think the recommendations are very sound that we have, but it's not necessarily a new story, but it is one that we worked very hard on. We had a very competitive proposal for use. And if we had had the 202 done by that time, I think the folks at Lewis could have seen the connectivity that the city created by accelerating the construction of the 202. They wanted to have a place where their parents could get quickly to their students from the airport. And they didn't like the idea of getting off at Dobson or whatever it was at the time back in 1997. So hopefully we can take some comfort that the recommendations, I think, further reinforce what we identified as a need and pursued 13 years ago. Hopefully we can do it again.
Two responses to that. Number one, that's great to hear. I hope that in 13 years we don't have a council. Dave Richens on his second thing doesn't say, gee, you know, 13 years ago I was in a thing, we really worked at this, and then somehow it dropped and we didn't continue doing that. So I hope, once again, this is a launching pad for some very specific and targeted and yet ongoing efforts. The second thing is the discussions that I've had, just like Councilman Kavanaugh talks about the 202, with institutions is centers around the benefits of an urban-based educational experience, which our downtown can and will offer. That's where light rail comes in. Light rail is the freeway, is the 202. And we shouldn't underestimate, because I can tell you in the discussions I've had so far, it's a huge deal as it relates to colleges and universities having light rail right there. It's the freeway of similar to the freeway, and they recognize the interaction and the experience that a resident college, and that's what we want, resident college students. Not we don't want commuter commuter school in downtown Mesa, ixnay. No, that should be by a freeway. We want resident students who can enjoy and build up a downtown. And the reason for that isn't because we're trying to force it, because it's a natural mix. You know, universities and urban experiences and urban settings are natural, and that's where light rail comes in. Okay, you got pretty pictures in here. Let's get to those.
No, I don't need to spend more time on this, but...
And Mayor, just to follow up and really summarize, we've already been in contact with seven different colleges and universities, ranging from small liberal arts schools to larger universities. So we've been moving forward with the initiative, as the mayor talked about, even before the study was complete. I think what our next step is really develop an RFI, put the criteria in place.
Acronym. Deposit your money on the way out.
Very good. Thank you. Request for information from universities and expressions of interest from them who may be interested in locating in our downtown, partnering with us as we go forward. But we really need to start a solid marketing effort to go at this and have a strategy in place to get that carried out as well. So I think that's our recommendation from here.
And just to add to that, I would suggest that all the discussions you've had so far have been reactive to institutions that are interested in you.
Yeah.
I think what we're suggesting is you need to be proactive in finding
aggressively
the institutions
market
that you want.
We're
and,
here.
And that's exactly
what we have to offer.
That's exactly our point.
Councilmember Summers.
On that point, Mayor, I guess if we're going to do an RFI, there was another community in the Valley who made it a strategy, actively market, did site visits, and went out to recruit colleges and universities, and that one fell flat. In retrospect, maybe a bit of a very short forensic exploration of what happened there. What happened in that community, and what does Mesa bring to the table different, and how do we avoid losing those opportunities like this other community did, or falling short, as oftentimes happens in Mesa, with Lewis University as an example. What do we bring to the table to close this deal, make it happen?
I'll render a short opinion with some caution, because my next meeting is in that community. So
I did the service to everybody of not mentioning where that is.
I think there were a couple different influencing factors that caused problems for that effort, although I would not say that effort is dead. It's certainly in trouble. Part of that was the economy and what happened to that community as a result of their ability, their economic capacity to participate with those institutions, and those institutions' capacity to actually make the investments that the city was going to require them to make. The second thing that happened was there was competition among a couple different private institutions, and they didn't want competition. They wanted their own place. And the third part that came into that is that a public institution made a very aggressive move to also establish a location in that site. And when the public institution comes in, there's a perception that's the 800-pound gorilla, and it would make it even more difficult for the private institution to compete.
Well, I like the way you danced around that.
You did a good job.
In other words, you put cats and dogs together, and then you threw a piece of meat right in the middle of them. And it's not a shocker that the thing sort of imploded. And they were all hungry.
They were all hungry.
Bad economy.
And then one of the institutions has moved its work up to another community in the Northwest Valley. And that process, in talking to members of that council, is moving a little bit too slowly for their liking. A lot of the initial work is online education, which they don't have any objection to, but doesn't provide the economic benefits they're looking for. So I think it's another example of being proactive, find the institutions with a strength, with the programs you want, that are complementary, that are looking for the kind of sites you have available, and going and getting them. And we know where they live.
So how do we avoid that? I mean, we've talked about light rail and the connectivity that has, mm-hmm. In that urban setting. What else is available downtown? What are we going to bring to the table? What are we putting in this RFI to say that Mesa is the site you want to belong to?
I think it's the same community assets we've talked about previously. We've been trying to leverage the city owns 60 acres just in its downtown. That's certainly an asset that we're looking to partner with. We have access through our Industrial Development Authority to low-cost financing. That's in place. And whatever other tools we can continue to develop I think would be important as we look to partner with these universities and colleges.
I hope that, once again, first of all, there's going to be more Lewis colleges?
Lewis University.
There's going to be more of those. I mean, the fact of the matter is, in order to get the right fit, there's going to be a lot of courting, and there's going to be things that this is hit and miss. This is a process, filtering process on both sides, and I hope that people don't expect that you put out an RFI and the first person that shows up, oh boy, you know, match made in heaven. The second thing is, our asset is not real estate, because real estate is fungible. Real estate is a commodity. And as we found out with Lewis University, there might be somebody out further that can offer a piece of ground better. And if we're selling our downtown that's purely on real estate, it's not the right fit. And I know that's important in the end. I mean, all those are important. But I hope that the way that we get the best fit that will complement our downtown, and thereby sort of a byproduct, create the kind of economic activity we want, is an institution that understands the overall assets that we have in downtown. And that is the urban experience. That is the availability of housing. That is a beautiful arts center, a library, an established urban and commercial center, and light rail. Oh, by the way, we have real estate here. We can make it work. So I hope that we approach it looking at assets as being more than just a piece of dirt. Because if we do that, I think we will miss out on it. So, okay. Can we summarize then real quickly what your belief is?
Our belief?
I guess to put it, do you believe, is it worth the effort? Is the opportunity out there? And is Mesa, and specifically downtown, a right fit? Now, I'm really putting you on that.
I'll answer the question directly with a little bit of a, not a, a caution, but a little bit of education.
Okay.
It is definitely worth it, I believe, in talking and doing the analysis that Sarah did. We believe that there is a great opportunity for the city of Mesa to do this effort. And you have the sites, you have the assets, and we believe it's worth making. It's not that dissimilar from any conscientious, proactive economic development, recruitment, or retention strategy you would undertake, except the targets of this process are not as sophisticated nor as experienced in site selection. They are place-based institutions for the most part.
We're sort of finding that out with Major League Baseball, too.
And so there is going to have to be a bit of a mutual education process that you have to be willing to go through to talk about what Mesa is, what it wants to be, and making sure you're getting the compatible fit, and that you may be a little bit more impatient with that process in this case than you.
Well, which is other lends itself to my comment, it can't be a real estate deal.
Right.
I think the fact is you're selling them on what they can accomplish, and you literally have to make sure that that's the right fit, and a lot of that is getting them to understand that it's the right fit. Okay. All right, any other questions? Hey, thank you so very much.
Appreciate you.
It. I guess what I've garnered from this is, as Councilmember Fender, and you, I'm just making a general statement. There's a lot of things here that I think we already knew, and it's maybe just confirmed what we knew. I think what it does is hopefully provide a foundation for specific efforts and specific opportunities, efforts, and it helps us to decide where and if we want and how resources we want to allocate toward the efforts in both the medical and the healthcare, medical and educational. Because I think there's no doubt that for the city of Mesa, these are areas of great opportunity. The question is, what's the next step in identifying specific efforts, and then where and how many resources, dollars and cents, staff, whatever, are we going to allocate to that to make it happen? Councilmember Richards.
Yeah, it's true. I think we did intuitively know a lot of this stuff, but the outside world doesn't.
Right.
And so that's what's great about having a report like this, is it gives us a piece that we can communicate with the outside world and people within Mesa even about what the opportunities are that are here.
Good point. Thank you. Okay. Next item on the agenda.
Mayor, council members, I come to you to tell you what I've done during my summer. last time I had a chance to chat with you about the zoning code update, it was June. We had released the public review draft. We had talked a little bit about some of the public education and public workshops that we had done. I start out with this slide because I keep trying to reinforce kind of graphically what we're trying to accomplish, which is to equalize and make the code a little bit more predictable. And we're doing that through three basic areas, through land use, impact, and form. The efforts that we made since the public review draft of the zoning ordinance update was released, we had several single-topic public workshops that took place during April and May. We kind of morphed those into specific workshops that took place in each of the individual council districts. We did that during the month of June. And then we have had, during the month of July, several special interest types of presentations. We made direct presentations to the Home Builders Associations in Scottsdale. We made direct presentations to Southeast Valley Brokers Association here in Mesa. And we've had direct presentations to several of the zoning attorneys that appear before you to represent various zoning cases. In addition to that, we've had significant discussions with each of the advisory boards, including the Design Review Board, the Economic Development Advisory Board, as well as P&Z. Specifically, we're going to go back to P&Z on September 15th, hopefully to ask them for some final direction before we release the final draft, which we'll use as the document that we'll publicize to make our final effort before final adoption. The schedule for the study sessions for the next 3 weeks includes some topic related to the zoning code update. Today I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of the changes that we're proposing to the public review draft, to some of the development standards. Next week I'd like to talk to you about some of the changes to some of the land uses. And then on the 16th we'll talk to you a little bit about some of the administration and processing changes that are involved with the code update. I'm trying to break down the topics a little bit to a little bit more manageable pieces. Specifically, most of the revisions we're talking about to development standards occur in Chapter 5. That's the residential district, or the residential chapter. It deals mainly with single-family and multifamily residents, as well as the new zoning district we're calling RSL, or residential small lot. Real quickly, we're proposing basically to allow 40-foot RVs on some of the larger lots. We've heard from some of the larger builders in town to reduce the minimum lot depth from 94 feet to 90 feet. That creates some flexibility in how they design their subdivisions. In addition to that, we've heard from some folks that feel that rather than having shallow, wide lots, they would like to have narrow, deep lots, but to keep the area the same. And so we've reduced the minimum width by 5 feet. So instead of a 60-foot width, we've gone to a 55. For example, the R1. We've clarified some language. And if you've read the Chapter 5 email that I sent out on Tuesday night, you'll see we also corrected some spelling grammatical areas. This graphic kind of shows how the 40-foot RV seems to fit a little bit easier on larger lots than it does on smaller lots. You can see how a 30-foot RV really takes up a lot of space on a 6,000-square-foot lot.
Councilmember Higgins.
Thank you, Mayor. Gordon, I missed something. Are we proposing this? I'm sorry, because I...
Yes, that's a proposed change that we've made.
So we're proposing that this 6,000-square-foot lot can have that 40-foot...
No, we're proposing that the 6,000-square-foot lot would remain at 30 feet, that at 15,000 feet we would allow the larger RVs.
Awesome. Thank you.
Mayor?
Yeah, Councilmember Richards?
Can we do some checking with the industry? Because it seems like some of the industry standards, I mean, there's a lot of 31, 32-foot RVs, and let's just make sure that we're kind of fitting in with what the industry is constructing. I don't know that I hear about a lot of 29-foot RVs. So I just to be sure that we're meeting the needs of, because a 31 or 32-foot RV probably wouldn't be as big a deal on a 6,000-foot lot, whereas the big diesel pushers are, you know, the big 40-foot thing. So let's just that way we're kind of mimicking what's in the industry.
Okay. Glad to do that.
One more follow-up.
Sorry.
So how tall is the typical 30 and 40-foot RV?
They're generally between 12 and 14 feet high.
So that means over a typical fence, you get 6 or 8 feet over the fence line, possibly only... How far? 15 feet from the house, the next house next door. What's the side yard minimum?
On the smaller lots, they may be as close as 4 or 5 feet.
Wow. Okay. So, the house, like in this picture, to the I'm assuming north is up. So the house to the west of this could have that RV at 12 feet high, 4 feet from its window. So it could actually block all natural light coming into this guy's house.
That, yeah, but that would be the homeowner's choice if he made that decision.
No, that, I'm talking about his neighbor to the west.
That potential is there also, yes.
Yeah, that's kind of, this is really close for me. I'm having issues just sharing.
This particular decision, the prior council made a compromise. The prior ordinance didn't have a restriction on boat locations. Mm-hmm. In order to get the boats behind the fence, they made a compromise to allow RVs to come forward from the rear quarter of the property to the side yard. And so this is kind of continuing that compromise. It just allows a little bit larger unit only when you get to the larger lot.
Well, actually, it'll be, because there'll be at least a, for an RV to fit in there, you're talking 10-foot side setbacks.
Minimum.
Yeah. So actually, it's not going to be 4 feet.
No, the neighbor could be closer.
Not from the neighbor, no. For the neighbor, it's going to be at least 11 feet.
If
you have 10-foot side setbacks, I guess you could have 5-foot setback on the one side?
You'd have, in the larger lots, you have a minimum 7-foot setback on.
Well, I'm talking about the smaller lots.
The smaller lots, it's 5 and 10.
Okay, so if you had 10-foot, which is what you have to fit an RV on, right, then you could have a 5-foot on the house to the west, mm-hmm, okay? Let's say it's the RV's 13 feet tall. That side of that RV would be at least 6 feet from the window.
Correct.
Because it's not going to be right on the property line. You're going to be at least a foot inside the property line because you got a wall there. And then you got a house that even if it's a single-story house, will peak up to 20 feet?
True.
At ridge?
Yes.
But not the window.
So it'll be below. So the RV will actually be below the roof line.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, it will be below the roof line of the house that it's parked next to. So actually, if it's going to block sunlight, the house will block the sunlight before the RV will block the sunlight.
Right. The question is whether is the proximity of the additional mass.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes. I got you. Councilman Bridge.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk. The next step in this then is a lot of people who have recreational vehicles or boats or anything like to have them parked under a covered structure. Mm-hmm. So how far could a structure come off the house to cover that RV? And can it be, does it have to be attached, detached, permanent, temporary?
We're proposing no changes to the detached building requirements or the setbacks relating to the primary structure. So if they wanted to provide a cover to the RV, they would have to put that in the rear quarter of the property.
Because if they put it here, then you can't put a structure. You have setback requirements.
Right.
So they couldn't put a cover that without violating those setback requirements.
Correct.
Because then the post and everything would have to be literally on the property line almost.
Exactly. So if they want, but there are exceptions to the setback requirements once you get into the rear quarter of the property.
Right.
Well, so, I mean, wouldn't we look at the same exceptions to the? I mean, why would we do that? It seems kind of odd that we wouldn't allow a cover to come. We'd allow somebody to park an RV there, but we wouldn't allow a fairly benign structure to cover it.
Are they really that benign? I think that's a problem.
It's just like a park. The
issue when you start getting too close to the property line becomes fire code issues, because typically you start rating the construction, and when you have open construction, it makes it more difficult to fire rate the construction.
So a little patio cover is more of a fire hazard than a 30-foot RV?
If there's a fire that's transporting from one property line to the other property line, it could be, yes.
Because you can drive the RV out. You can't drive
on fire?
Well, that's the thought process. I agree with you, but that's the thought process. You can move the RV. You can't move the patio, the structure. It's permanent. Wait, you're thinking rationally now. Stop that.
Well, why do one if you're not going to do the other? Because now I'm going to have a bunch of people who want to park RVs on the sides of their house, and they're going to want to build what seems like a relatively benign patio cover type structure next to it, and then they're not going to be able to allow to, and so then we're going to have fights. So if we're not going to do one, let's not do the other. Let's just be consistent. Because that's what it seems like a lot of them want to do, are these additional cover type structures. If I parked my boat on the side of the house, I'd want to build a cover so it was under cover. And I can't.
On the smaller lots, it's more difficult to do. On the larger lots, obviously, there's more room to do it. We could try to look at some exceptions to encroachments for those types of activities that take place on the larger lots. quite frankly, once you start getting down to the smaller lots, you just run out of space.
I mean, is there a way to do it through exceptions in materials, you know, fireproof materials or something like that? Say they built it out of steel, you know, those kind of things. I just want to find a way in the code that if people want to do these things, maybe we need to figure out.
I can speak with the building safety staff and see if there are materials to do that. There's another aspect of this that I'll talk
Gordon,
about.
Gordon, if I could, let me see if I can clarify that one other thing. Today, you can park that 30-foot RV in the side yard in the 6,000-square-foot lot. So the only thing we're changing is to allow the 40-foot once you get in the 15,000-square-foot lot or bigger. So those challenges that you're concerned about are challenges that have been in the code for
Okay. That's what I'm trying to get at. Okay. I'm trying to hear about it.
The problem you get is that you get people who want to build the structure, you get complaints from them, and then, believe me, I've been in enough where the neighbors then complain because someone built an ugly patio out to the side of their house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, this is a no-win situation. And, you know, I've seen a lot more ugly shade structures that offend the neighborhood than I have RVs parked there that come and go and will be gone when that person moves out of they're not permanent. They will be gone when that person moves out of the house. It seems like you get fewer negative situations when people can't build the structure than you do when you allow them to build the structure, because then you've upset the whole street. And I've been in neighborhood situations where the entire street was upset because Bill over there wanted to build a shade structure for his RV, and everyone got ticked off because it just didn't fit. It looked awkward, didn't fit. So it's a no-win situation. Councilmember Higgins.
Mr. Wesley, so today the 30-foot can park in the 6,000-square-foot lot.
Yes.
Do they also, when they build a shade structure, does that have to come through building safety for approval? So. Well, that's the case. So it should, and those that aren't
are illegal,
are violent.
Right, and when we look at those,
they still meet setbacks. As your experience on the Board of Adjustments saw, we had several folks that were asking for shade structures variances to get into the side yards, and the board routinely denied those.
So there's always, there's that one last look at whether it's an ugly shade structure or not through through building safety, right?
Yes.
Does that help?
Well, but they look at that.
But they're looking at it for the technical aspect. They're not looking at the aesthetics.
No, I mean, we have to spend $800 to even go through that process. It's kind of defeats the purpose.
So I don't get what you just said. Can you explain that? No, I mean, how can we help this?
I don't know. I don't know what the solution is, and I'm hoping it just can be addressed within this process. I don't have a solution.
Vice Mayor is going to add some wisdom to this,
because
he always has a good way of adding wisdom to these situations.
Thank you, Mayor.
Yeah. Pressure's
Gee.
On. Kyle.
Well, I am really not interested in opening a can of worms to try and allow structures, because you always have people who are going to push the envelope, and they're going to have disgruntled neighbors all over. If you have a boat, if you have an RV, and you want to cover it, you just need to go to the back quarter of the yard. If you can't accommodate that, find another place to store it, but we just don't need to open that can of worms. And I will not support any change otherwise.
Yeah, like I said, it's a no-win situation. I would tend to agree with the Vice Mayor that choose the lesser of what always ends up being two evils.
Okay. I think I got my direction. The part of the proposed ordinance talked about some of the form requirements related to the garage on single residence homes. In particular, it indicated that no more than 50% of the front of the house should take place as what constitutes the garage. In talking to the Home Builders Association a little bit, we tried to define what constitutes the garage. We're adding language that the garage would be defined by the width of the garage door, not necessarily the garage structure. And they've agreed with that. In addition to that, we took a look at some of the dimensional requirements. We had set aside a minimum width for three-car garages that face the front at 85 feet. We feel we can fit them on 75 feet, so we've narrowed that, again, at the request of the Home Builders Association. We've clarified some exceptions to some of the separation requirements, particularly side-facing doors and door and garage doors that are set back 1.5 times from the front setback, and we seem to have agreement on that. In addition to that, we have there's a requirement that we talk about in which, in order to, again, try to get more eyes on the street, try to create a more active street, we're trying to bring the livable area forward on the lot. And so in terms of the front plane of the house, the idea is to have the garage set back about 5 feet from the main front plane and bring the active area forward. And what we came up, we got some significant pushback from the home builders folks about this. What we came up with as a compromise is something that the city of Peoria is doing, which is called the facade articulation alternative. And the idea is that they present designs in their subdivision where they show that the plane, the front planes of the elevations of the home move in and out, and that there's at least a minimum of 4 feet between the back front plane of the home and the front plane of the home. I'm trying to figure out an easy way to say
the front plane.
Well, the idea is that there would be the well, here I can. It's probably a little bit easier to see.
I'm just trying to get over the little tail you have on your facade.
The computer did that. I have no idea where that came from. I just put a C in, and I get that.
You get that little tail on that.
And it happens every time I write facade on every single font I use. So
do we have to pronounce it differently?
Facade, I guess.
Facade.
Okay. I'm not sure, but the idea is that if you have a plan design on this particular side, it has only two front planes. Then there's 4 feet of difference between, in this case, the yellow line and the red line. Whereas if you have three front planes, there's only 2 feet of difference between the planes, but the very front plane and the very back plane, there's still 4 feet of difference.
And I didn't understand it until you used the word undulation. Really explained it for me.
I borrowed that from the Peoria folks. I take no credit for the originality of that.
Nor would you want to.
Okay, but again, the problem we're trying to address is the idea that you have these monotonous facades where you have garages that are lining up all the way across, and there seems to be a lack of activity, especially with eyes forward on the street.
Yeah, and the one thing that I would caution us, like, because believe me, I've been through gobs of this in writing codes in another city, is that you trade one boredom for another boredom. I mean, it's variation, and or I should say variety, is what creates great streetscapes, not the fact that the garage is up, back, or whatever, because if every house has the garage back and the living straight, you have the same boredom and the same monotony.
Sure.
That you do. Oh, there you go.
The idea behind this basically is that we would set a cap, so to speak, at 40% of the garages forward and 60% of the active part of the house forward. And the idea is that you get that mix and that variety that's there. And and they would provide exhibits to that as part of their submittals to show that this type of articulation, this undulation, so to speak, would actually take place in the subdivision design.
Now, when we have base standards, now the natural law of nature is when you have production builders, standardized plans and, you know, three different footprints with four different elevations are what home builders do so they can make money. How do we do that? How do we do that to where we can get away from that in these subdivisions over 25 lots? Do we offer any kind of density bonuses? Do we offer any other kind of things in the new code that would encourage them to get away from the, we're going to have three separate, three footprints and three garage locations, and we're going to dress them up differently?
My understanding from in talking with the home builders folks and talking with some of the architects is that, for the most part, they're already doing this type of thing in other cities. So it's not an unusual request right. for us to do this. And on top of that, my also understanding is that they're also getting market demand for this type of variety in the subdivisions also. The slide that I've got up now, just real quickly to show you how some of that undulation works, you can see exactly, for example, the photograph that's in the upper left side, the house that's on the right, the garage is forward. And then you have the house on the left. the garage is back and they're bringing the house forward. Obviously, the house that's on in the upper right, there's a lot of undulation going on just because of the nature of the house itself. There's a lot of creativity in that design. I wanted to bring the slide, the picture that's down to the bottom left, to your attention. That's actually a duplex. Those garages are attached, but they're set far back on the lot, and you get the active portions forward. So that's just another alternative design. And then you have the variety of setbacks that take place where, in the lower right picture, where you have some of the homes are set back a little forward and some of the houses are set back a little bit back, again, to create that kind of variety so you don't have all the garage doors lining up in the same plane.
Hey, Gordon?
Yes.
You know, the one thing that you look at here, and one thing I practiced a lot, and I know I'm treading on sacred ground here, you know, setback in that is one aspect of variety. The other thing is a variation in colors, mm-hmm. obviously elevation, building materials, and roof tiles. And I know the market has moved that way. What can we do in our codes to encourage that, not regulate it, but encourage it? Variety of color schemes, and you know, not having two houses next to each other that have the same exact color, same exact roof tiles, same exact elevation.
The City Council, I believe it was in 1998, passed something called the Residential Development Guidelines, which we use as kind of a review of the actual models that have come in. Part of those Residential Development Guidelines talk about differences in color, differences in materials, differences in roof materials. Projects that are in excess of 4 acres through this ordinance would become subject to the Residential Development Guidelines, and they would have their product reviewed to assure that variety.
Okay.
The other issue we came up with the Home Builders Association was the concept of allowance. We had allowed porches and active areas of the home to have a 10-foot encroachment in the front yard, where we don't have that now. Currently, the minimum setback in the smaller districts is only 20 feet. We are going to allow a 10-foot setback for active and porch areas, but still keep the garage back setback at 20 feet. The Home Builders Association would like us to allow that allow side yard or side entry garages also at the 10-foot setback, believing that giving that allowance also provides some of that variety in forms. Staff has resisted that for the most part, believing that, again, we're trying to keep the active portion of the house forward, and even when you get a side entry garage, you're really pushing the active portion of the house back. And so it kind of defeats what we were trying to accomplish by giving the allowance for the active area of the home to come forward on the lot. So we're proposing not to make that allowance. We do have the articulation, which would allow 40% of the garages to be forward on the in subdivision, but we're not necessarily give the additional 10 foot.
I can appreciate what you're doing, and I don't disagree with trying to get the active area forward. I think if our purpose is to create variety in street scenes, I 100% agree with you. If we're trying to force people to be more neighborly by putting their living room up front, it's not going to work. You can't dictate human behavior.
Sure.
People want to be neighborly and they want to be eyes to the front. They're going to be that way. If they don't, they don't. They're going to stay in their house. I would agree with the home builders in the sense that I don't think it's a bad thing to allow the garages side entry, because I think what you gain by getting a few side entry at the 10 foot is more than makes up for what you give up. Now, saying that, an entire subdivision of side entry 10 foot setbacks create that same kind of monotony and defeat the purpose you're talking about. I think I would support and throw out the idea that perhaps you allow that, but on a limited basis.
The possibility would be to allow that as part of that articulation plan.
Yeah, yes. And you say that a certain number of percentage or number of houses can have that, but it can't be, you know, five houses in a row or things like that. Now, I know we're getting detailed here.
Well, I want to make, in before I go too far for it, I just want to make sure I've got the consensus of the council to do that. So.
You just one out of don't do the math. One out of seven doesn't work for you. You see what I mean?
I'm I, like I think I've heard a couple of cats. I'm trying to herd cats here, so.
No, you are. You are. And this is a this is not the greatest forum for us to be micromanaging, but
no,
we can't help it in this case. I'm sorry.
No, I understand.
So I'm trying to stay away from that, but and I probably should have just been quiet, but I just had to make that statement.
I like that idea, Mayor. The only thing, when I'm looking at this picture, I'm wondering if it conflicts with another portion of code that says that you can't have your front yard more than 50% hardscape. So my concern would be on that side driveway, is that all of a sudden that's going to be 60% of it's going to be hardscape because of the turn you have to make with it?
Because the setback would change. If you took a look at this, it would be 50% in front of that yellow line as opposed to 50% of the red line.
All right.
Yeah.
I've seen some subdivisions in North Phoenix that have exactly the 10-foot side garage thing, and they do it pretty successfully by mixing it exactly.
Well, the only difference...
So they're doing it now. It's an industry trend.
Yeah, you have structure 10 feet away. The only difference is the garage 10 feet versus a porch 10 feet or living area 10 feet. Because if you have a recessed garage, we allow, even under the proposed revisions, living space to be up 10 feet. That's the trade-off. So the only question we're having here is, would we allow a side entry garage to be 10 foot with windows to a garage versus windows to a living room or a porch?
Right.
Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. Is there any?
Well, I just wondered because I was recently in a neighborhood in Chandler that has that, but actually has the garage and a living area and a like fenced in patio in front of the house. Mm-hmm. And so you look at what you think is a garage, but actually is a garage and a ends up being like a bonus room with
any flat or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you walk through a gate, and then they have this beautiful courtyard, and then the back of the house, then the house kind of thing. But there's like, I don't even think it's 10 feet from the sidewalk. It's very small. But, I mean, it really maximizes that lot for the homeowner.
Sure.
You know, and gives it a neighborhood. I don't know if it's the neighborhood I would like to live in, but it gives options.
Right.
So I don't know if I know where you're going, and I'm like, yeah, I'm okay with that, I guess.
Councilor Ridge?
Yeah, I think the thing to be sensitive to is kind of the septet approach to this, too, the crime prevention through environmental design, that if you allow too much of garage up front, you don't have any eyes on the street. That's why the bullnose garage thing's bad, because you can't even see your cars. So I think the trade-off is you know, there needs. I think of the same subdivision in Phoenix, and I've seen houses that have the side rear garage and then a front-loading garage, too, so they have their three-car garage. There's no windows to the street whatsoever. No, you have to open the front door to be able to see out in front. So I think some combination that allows this kind of thing but also encourages eyes to the street, I think, might work.
So if I understand correctly, if we do the side entry garage, we put that as part of the allowance for the facade articulation plan so that we get some eyes on the street for some of the lots, and some of the lots are allowed with the garage in the front. There's the combination there that there may be enough eyes on the street that we can still accomplish.
Yeah, I think once again, the idea is to create variety, variation, and move living area space forward.
Safety.
If a developer came in, a home builder came in and said, hey, listen, we'll create this variety. Can you give us this one thing? I think we accomplished the overall purpose.
Right.
If they came in and said, we just want this, then we're not accomplishing our purpose and would say no. So if we can throw this as a bone that will get us something else that will accomplish the greater good, I guess that's what I was getting at.
Okay.
So limited application with the understanding that this would be part of that whole facade, what'd you call that? Articulation. The better the facade articulation, I think the more flexibility we should give to the home builder because we're accomplishing what we really want to accomplish.
Okay.
Okay.
Got it. Okay. And just some more, this kind of shows just kind of graphically and three-dimensionally we're talking about. The next set of discussion we've had was this, with the new district we're proposing, which is the residential small lot, the RSL, particularly with some of the discussions we had with regard to how small or how narrow the lot would be, as well as how much open space we were talking about. We've made some concessions to allow decks, courtyards, and porches to be counted as part of the open space requirement. We clarified some of the landscaping requirement related to open space. We reduced the garage. If you have an alley-loaded product, as opposed to a front-loaded product. We reduced the garage setback in the rear so that it's relatively close to the alley itself, but still you can get the turning radius there so you can get the car in, or if you have a large car like a Suburban or something, you could get that turned in. We eliminated the maximum lot coverage in the residential small lot districts because, quite frankly, they kind of...
I always love the fact like someone has a Suburban and they live in a small lot, rear-loaded, alley-loaded house. That happens. It's just amazing.
We reduced the garage setback from the primary building from 5 feet to 3 feet so that, for example, on a 45-foot wide lot, you could go with a tandem type of approach to the garage and still be able to fit that on there.
As a matter of fact, as far as those driveways and the alley load, there should also be a maximum. The worst thing that can happen is to have a 10-foot driveway on an alley-loaded garage because it's just big enough that people will park.
Second car.
They'll park sideways, they'll park it diagonally, they'll stick out into the alley. And actually, 5 foot is about as maximum as you ever want that to be, because then there's the temptation is not there to block the alley.
Okay.
You go 10 feet, you'll get blockage.
We also had some discussions. One of the ideas behind the RSL is that in order to get a higher quality subdivision, there were certain design elements we had. In order to achieve a higher density, they would provide more of those design elements as part of the design. So we would reward folks for higher quality designs by giving them better density or higher density. We got some pushback because, quite frankly, if you take a look at the design elements, some of them kind of overlap. And so it was difficult to try to achieve the higher numbers. And so we kind of cut those back a little bit by two, but still keep the minimum numbers so we don't get that overlap. I think we're in agreement with that with the home builders folks. In addition to that, we had some significant discussions about open space. There was a typo in there that on one part we said 500 square feet, another part of the code we said 400 square feet. We've clarified that at 400 square feet. In the larger lots, we came up with also a combination scheme whereby you could achieve that 400 square feet of open space either by putting that on the individual lots themselves or by a combination where you provide at least 350 square feet of open space on the individual lots, but then you have common open space that would be achieved at a ratio of 100 square feet per unit. And so you'd have some common open space there. We realize that that adds up to more than 400 square feet. It adds up to 450. But you really need a little bit larger ratio for the common open space in order to achieve anything that's of usable size. The smaller districts, the RSL 3.0 and the 2.5, we went with a combination of 280 and 120. And that seems to work out fairly well for the smaller lots. We also established the fact that the minimum common open space is a quarter acre in order to be considered usable. That's around roughly about 10,000, a little over, just under 11,000 square feet. And then we also had a requirement that said that...
Is that dry, or can that be accomplished in a retention basin?
That could be it could be achieved numerous ways. It could be a retention.
Well, I mean, but we don't require. I mean, if we have open space, that whole 11,000 feet could be at the bottom of a retention basin.
It could.
We don't require that it be dry.
No.
Okay.
And we had there. In addition to that, the public review draft had a dimension that said that in order for open space to be counted, you had to have a minimum 15-foot dimension in all directions. We reduced that to 10. That makes it a little bit more workable to actually fit a house on a lot and make the house usable. And we think that will work as well. Councilmember Fincher specifically had asked me about this, and I'm trying to address his issue. This has to do
with... Of course, we're looking for a consensus.
We're bringing it to the council.
How come you listen to him? You won't listen to me.
Mr. Fincher was...
You should listen to him because he
was persistent. I heard this two or three times.
You know what? Councilmember Fincher gets a free pass on a lot of things after what he did a week or so ago.
This has to do with the little utility sheds that they sell at Home Depot or Lowe's that people commonly put in their side yards and are technically zoning violations. And what ends up happening is someone calls in a zoning violation and everybody else in the neighborhood all of a sudden becomes in violation of the same thing, and they never realized it because they never had to get a building permit for it. They just went to Home Depot, bought the shed, and put it in their side yard. What we part of the issue with these is that if you put the wrong materials in these sheds, quite frankly, they can be a cause for fire, and the fire can spread. And if you get too close to the property line, the fire spreads not only to their own home, but the fire can spread to the neighbor's home.
But if they're attached to an RV, then it doesn't matter, right?
Okay? If you can drive it.
If you can drive it.
If you can drive
it. Put
shed,
it on wheels.
Then it's fine.
Okay.
This meeting's getting too long.
I'll try to be...
No, it's not you.
What we came up with after talking with the building safety folks is that if we keep the height to less than 6 feet, so it doesn't become something that a person can walk into all the time, we limit the size of these to 120 square feet or less, and most of these are somewhere between 40 and 80 square feet. And we provide a gypsum board, a 5/8 inch gypsum board, on the two sides of the shed where the fire could spread potentially. Then we could allow these as a by right condition. And there wouldn't be any permits for these types of things. We could control it, it's not perfect, but we could control the spread of the fire and at least delay it enough so that there was a fire and someone found out about it. We could get the fire department out there and without...
But how many of those that you buy at Home Depot have 5/8 inch gypsum boards?
This is something you'd have to add to the inside of the shed after you have.
We're going to go around with inspectors and look in the inside of...
What this does is, it's technically a violation now. What this does is give the person the option to say, okay, if you put the gypsum board inside, you can leave it where it's at, and they don't have to go to the Board of Adjustment to request a variance that they may not get.
Mayor?
Yeah, Councilmember Higgins?
My concern with this is that, like the ones you just said, you buy at Home Depot, you buy at Costco, they're taller than 6 feet. I mean, they are. They got the little peak roof,
right,
and you can walk in and out, and now it's a different thing because now you're... right on the side of the house, and you can see it over the fence. And it.
There are those that are higher than 6 feet. There's several that they sell that peak out at 6 feet or just a little bit under.
So we're only going to allow something 6 feet or less, so you don't see it from your neighbor's yard. It's going to be under the fence.
The wall's part of the control mechanism.
Okay, so when it's above that, then the neighbor has to take it down or move it somewhere in their property.
Or move it to the correct place on
okay.
the
wall.
Is that 6 feet to the peak of the roof?
Yes.
Or?
I can appreciate what you're trying to accomplish here. I don't know. I wonder why we make rules that we have no chance of enforcing.
The reality that we have now is that folks are putting these in there now, and the existing code's not getting enforced that well. What we're trying to do is to say,
as I've always said, if it's already broken, why break it further?
Well, we're trying to recognize the condition and give them at least an option so they can keep it where it makes it useful.
I think you're well-intentioned. I'm not sure that we're doing anything but spitting in the wind, because if they're already ignoring it, they'll ignore it.
I think it's he's trying to create a mechanism, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. It was key when he said, create a condition that they can rectify an existing bad condition.
Whereas right now they have no option.
Out going through the Board of Adjustment, which is, an $800 application or something like that.
Gotcha. So at least we put it out there that if they choose to do it,
they get caught.
Gotcha.
You can do this, and we're all good.
I got you.
Right?
Okay. Yeah, Councilmember Fender. That makes sense.
And I appreciate that. The experience we had in one particular neighborhood, when one person calls in, 8 other people are cited, a code enforcement officer spending a lot of time trying to remedy a challenge. That takes quite an expensive process to go through Board of Adjustment and finding a more reasonable solution is really important. I appreciate the flexibility. That's all I was ever looking for is, a flexible, reasonable look at this that kind of meets halfway in the middle.
If the 6 foot, I'm not necessarily saying it has to be. If you feel that it's reasonable to go up to 7, or 7.5, something like that, we could probably work with that too. If that's what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think there's an industry standard thing here. Go down to Home Depot or Costco, measure what they're selling down there, and let's try to make it.
Well, a lot of them sell at 6 feet because if you go into an HOA, their requirements are much more stringent than the city's. You can't see it.
Problem.
Right. Well, that's why I think Home Depot and those build them to 6 feet and not 6 foot one, is so people can, in HOAs, can put them in the back. Let me ask you something real quickly.
Sure.
How do you get a variance through a Board of Adjustment to put a building?
You don't.
I was going to say, because state, variances for setbacks are driven by state law primarily, and how do you How in the world could you ever comply with the hardship requirement?
Most people don't.
Can you give me an example?
You can tell me afterwards.
Most people don't. There are occasions where they are, where the board does approve it, but it doesn't happen very often.
Topography.
And just to follow up, again, on the detachability of these, the idea was that side yard that could need might be needed for serviceability in the back with a backhoe or anything, this allows it to be detached, and so we don't eliminate that that need. So that I appreciate that, but there is a need, you know, with the monsoons and everything, that there has to be some sort of adherence or they're all going to be sitting in the street.
The thought is that we would utilize temporary anchors like augers or straps or those kinds of things. Right. It wouldn't be on a permanent foundation. It wouldn't have plumbing or electrical fixtures.
Exactly.
It would tie it into the house.
Very reasonable. I appreciate the reasonable part of things. So.
Okay, and then again, this just kind of, the narrative kind of explains a little bit more about the details of this, which we've talked about. Portable storage containers. And this came from our discussions we had in Council District 1 and the Lehigh folks. Right now, they're prohibited in single residence districts, and they're allowed in commercial districts only in very limited circumstances. This was a specific ordinance the council passed in 2003. Basically, the exception to commercial districts is only during on-site construction or to kind of meet peak demand for storage, like during layaway storage for retail at holidays. The proposal we have from the Lehigh folks is if they dress it up and make it not look like a storage container, then maybe we should allow these things. Staff has some difficulty with this, partly because it puts us in the position of trying to judge aesthetics in a single residence district. And for the most part, we try to stay out of trying to actually judge the aesthetics. We're just looking for things like materials and things like that. We prefer not to do this. We think the ordinance that's in place that the council passed in 2003 tries to address the issue.
Is that picture... Is someone like turn a playhouse? Is that what that is, or what
they,
is that?
Someone bought a port storage place and they tried to make it look like some sort of log cabin.
But I mean, is that used for storage or is that just like for play?
It's probably a playhouse.
Okay,
it could be some storage.
Councilman Rich,
so are you talking about these big shipping containers,
yes,
the ocean-going shipping containers? Because I mean, there is a whole
mini storage.
Yeah, there's a whole thing around people that have built really interesting architecturally structures, layering these things on top of each other.
Correct.
So, I mean, it's, I don't know that we should completely close the door on it. I mean, it can add, I mean, look at the Quonset Hut art studio we have on Center Street. You know, it's some people like it, some people don't. But I think it adds a nice layer of variety to the city. So,
I guess the issue is
well, now
there are ways to
go online and look at them because they're not. They don't look like a stack trailer park. You look at it, and you'll be. And plus, it's very green because you're reusing these containers in ways. So go online and check them out, just so you know. Before we, I don't think we should completely close the door on it. I know everybody's snickering here, but it's worth a look.
My son showed me restaurants, for example, that were built out of these reused storage things, but they're very architecturally. And
there are ways to qualify those as a building structure because through the engineering diagram, on putting on a permanent foundation, those types of things, they end up becoming steel construction. The question is, should we allow these just a crane or a tow truck to put them on the back lot of the property, place it on the property, and not do anything to it at all, where you just have basically a metal box in the backyard? And so the prior council had said, no, they didn't want that in a residential district. The Lehigh folks said, is there a way
to... Aren't those the same? Isn't it the same philosophy over the Home Depot storage things? If it's greater than 120 square feet, wouldn't that fall under that purview?
Because of building code changes, if it gets over 200 square feet, it's required.
It went up to 200 square feet for...
Yeah, it's if it goes over 200 square feet, now it's required to be a building.
Oh, so those... Oh, 20-foot... So you could have a 20-foot container that's 200 square feet.
Right. And then so you have to qualify as a building, but these don't qualify as a building because they're not on a permanent foundation.
Wait, no, they're at 200 square feet, so they don't have to qualify.
Under 6 foot.
If it's under 6 foot, but those aren't under 6 feet, are they?
No.
So wouldn't they
they're,
just...
They're generally 8 to 10 feet high.
So they would fall under the same rules as this as the Home Depot storage units, basically.
They're a little bit bigger than that because they're...
No, but what I mean, though, is the same... I guess what I'm trying to say is whether you go to Home Depot and buy
The larger buildings, they would have to be placed... If they qualified as a building, they would have to be placed in the rear quarter of the property.
Right. And if they don't qualify, it's the same set of rules that we use for the Home Depot storage unit. Because if they're over 6 feet tall, if they're 200 square feet or under, then they got to be under 6 feet. If they're 6 feet or under, why do we care? Isn't that the same as the Home Depot? If they're over 6 feet, then we do care because we already have a set of rules that says what you can do.
Right, but none of these are under 6 feet.
Well, I know. That's what I'm saying, though. Don't our existing rules already regulate what they can do with these?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I was just trying to understand that. Yeah, okay. Well, rather than treat them as a separate set of rules, we have one set of rules that would seem to apply to the same basic thing. Am I making this way more complicated than it seems to be?
I'm probably making it more complicated than it seems to be. I apologize.
Well, it seems to me if it's 200 square feet or less and 6 feet or less, we don't care. Since none of these qualify for that, because even the 20-foot containers are 8 to 10 feet tall, then they violate the basic rules anyway. They're a building.
Yeah.
So they got to be treated as a building.
Mayor.
Councilman Hagan.
But the whole purpose is there's a group of residents that would like to be able to use these in the big open areas like in Lehigh.
Mm-hmm.
So now that's been the question, which is it a different area and should it be addressed differently? And I'm willing to talk about that because it is a different area and it's not the same. You know, a 4-acre whatever in Lehigh is not the same as, you know.
The question is, would we get that under my scenario, would we get that excited if on a 3 or 4 acre parcel if we had an 8-foot Home
No, that's why I think, yeah, but it's okay. That, but per code, they can't do it. So that's why it's even brought up in the first place.
Once again, you have enlightened me. Thank you.
Go on the rear quarter.
So I guess, do you want to consider these on larger lots then? Or do we want to continue to prohibit them?
I think you need to start keep talking about it. And
yeah, I mean, again, okay. I think the larger lots in the more rural areas in the city, where we're allowing them to have chickens and horses and goats, They're
so
different. They're unique.
Options.
We should
develop some options and bring it the question.
I think that the challenge I have is, once again, I don't care how big the lot is. You start putting containers that aren't decorated and aren't, it looks like a junkyard.
Right.
And it has the appearance that they're garbage. And I understand they're not. But you know what? It is reuse, which means somebody threw it away and you're reusing it. I have no problem if you see some details like what we've seen where they're really dressed up, but how often does that happen?
Not very often.
Yeah, if you regulate it. Now, once again, we're spending a lot of time doing a lot of regulation. I thought we were trying to lower regulation but still maintain quality.
The one caution I throw to it is sometimes you put one of these things, particularly in Lehigh, it happens where people are running contracting businesses out of their homes, and they use those storage containers to store materials for their business. So you're getting in this quasi-commercial residential stuff. So, I mean, that's the one thing that does worry me about letting this go.
Was it a non-conforming use, or is it zoned, or are they already in violation?
No, they're in violation.
It would be a violation because it's commercial use in a residential.
Yeah, they're doing in a residential.
So we're already turning a blind eye to the degree, so should we turn a bigger blind eye?
That's the policy question.
But the question is, if it was architecturally pleasing, would you have as big a problem with it?
It's not whether I would. The question is whether the neighbors would.
Well, right. You go back to the fundamental issue. Can you run a business out of a residential?
Yeah.
You've passed the issue about the...
My real thinking is you have rules not so you can tell people what they can and can't do. You have rules so you level the playing field, so people can move into a neighborhood with some expectation that there are standards. And you want those standards to be reasonable and fair. You know, if someone's running a business and none of the neighbors care, I don't know why I care, unless there's a health and safety issue. If it's architecturally pleasing. But unfortunately, we don't get the chance to be able to make that decision on every situation, so we got to find some way to set a rule.
Well, Mayor, I just want to make sure, you know, we're a huge city, right? You said 140, I think it's 135 square miles, but nonetheless, 500,000 people. There's
four Mesa Proving Grounds.
Such a huge difference in our neighborhood, so... We shouldn't have a one-size-fits-all kind of mentality. Some areas, some things will work, some areas it won't. So
right,
I think it's worth looking into is the whole point.
Yeah, and I don't want to completely close the door on commercial reuses of these. You know, and if somebody wants to do a creative restaurant or something, mm-hmm. I don't want to completely close the door on that, saying any use of these in the city is prohibited.
Well, they're allowed in commercial.
On a temporary basis. And there are ways to qualify these as a building for commercial.
I think what I'm hearing is that Councilmember Richens and Councilmember Higgins would like to work with you on further defining how we might carve out some sort of workable exception.
I'll make myself
so how about
helpful.
We go for there, okay?
Awesome.
Thank you.
Okay. So anyway, the idea basically is outside of the portable storage, I've got concurrence for most of these changes from the council. Does that sound?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
Thank you.
We just don't want to open the door and create a problem where, you know, people abuse it, and then we have real legitimate neighborhood concerns. I would have a problem if someone put that in their backyard and it looked like a junkyard. Yeah, so, and I think most neighbors would too. Okay?
Okay.
Hey, thank you so very much. We really do.
Sure.
You know, I'm sorry, you know, this seems like we're rushing through some of these things because I know you guys put a lot of work into this and a lot of thought, and this is not easy to do because you have a lot of interests and everyone has their own idea of how best to go about this. So I really appreciate the work you've done.
Mayor, we're 95% there.
Good.
We're gonna get you a final code real soon.
Well, yeah, I'm confident it'll be well worth the effort. Thank you. All righty. Hear reports on meetings and conferences attended. Any reports?
Yeah.
Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, last night we had a very successful Falcon Field open house with over 75 residents in attendance, which was a nice turnout. Staff did a wonderful job at organizing a very informative open house. Everyone that was I spoke with, I should say the vast majority of people I spoke with came in order to support the airport, which was great to hear. So a lot of pilots, a lot of neighbors who have planes that are housed at Falcon Field, and they just wanted to come out and show their support. So it was a very nice event.
Great. Thank you. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
I think, Mayor, yesterday I attended the monthly meeting of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, had a presentation from Mike Lafrano of the Cubs. It was very lively discussion from the hoteliers there, since they pointed out they're providing 30% of the financing for the bed tax, that they have some interesting opinions on sites and pros and cons of those and expressed those yesterday. So it was a lively discussion. Thank you, Mayor.
They resolve anything?
They have definite viewpoints, Mayor.
Okay. Nice way to say that. Anything else? Great. Mr. Brady.
From the council, we have study session next Thursday, September 9th. And then later that afternoon, on that day in the afternoon, there will be a Community Neighborhood Services Committee. And our next council meeting is on September 13th. Thank you.
Any requests to speak from the public?
Move for adjournment.
I have a motion to adjourn from Vice Mayor, second council member Summers. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you so very much. Appreciate it.